This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 80, taking out the con baby. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including an update on the upcoming console game, William Shatner's TNG documentary, announced bonus features for the Enterprise Season 1 Blu-rays, new images from Into Darkness, a terminally ill fan's final dream, and Benedict Cumberbatch and Chris Pine on the cover of Empire. Plus, we mark the 20th anniversary of Deep Space Nine. Then in the feature, we're joined by Larry Nemechek and John Tenuto to go behind the scenes of The Wrath of Khan, to places you've never been before. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year to you, Chris. I'm doing quite well. My Seahawks won some sports ball today. So I'm coming to this in a very good mood. How are you doing?
That's good. Speaking of sports ball, tomorrow is the national championship game, and I certainly hope that my Crimson Tide wins. Otherwise, I might be ranting on Twitter a little bit. But no, we only took a week off of the show. I guess that's actually 2 weeks in terms of time between recording. It feels like it's been about a month since we recorded a Ready Room.
It does. It feels, for some reason, like it's been an awfully long time since we did the show. I know it's only been 2 weeks, but I guess between the two holidays and the other podcasts I've done, it just feels like it's been ages since we've talked about Star Trek here.
It does, yeah. There's so much going on during the holidays that we had our usual routine here with the family, a lot of family events, going out to the temple, drinking sake in the cold, ringing the bell, or as I call it, airlocking 2012. And now we're finally into a new year, so I'm glad it's here. Speaking of that, Greg, StarTrek.com, they asked their readers, what's your Trek-centric New Year's resolution? And I thought we would read a couple of comments from readers, and then I wanted to ask you, what is your personal Trek-centric resolution?
Sure.
Darren Keaty said that his is to see the new movie in his ST2 uniform. Now, I don't know if that means his maroon jacket from The Wrath of Khan, or if he's going to be making his own uniform to match the new JJ movie.
Yeah, that would be my question. I mean, I think you can buy uniforms, or you will be able to buy Into Darkness uniforms by the time of the film's release. So it's possible that that's what he means. I think it would be much funnier if he goes as a Wrath of Khan uniform, because I do love those maroon uniforms. Aside from the fact that they don't differentiate well enough between the different divisions, that's the one thing I miss in those. I think the sweater changes, but you don't really see the sweater that much. But it is a nice uniform. That's a fancy uniform.
Yeah. I still think those are the best. They're still my favorite uniforms. I love the First Contact DS9 uniforms, but I really love the original series movie uniforms, not the motion picture ones, but the later ones. What else do we have here? We have, I think this is a good one. Eileen Johnson says, I will live well, laugh much, love lots, hang out more with my Trek Club friends, and prosper. I think that's good advice for everyone this year.
That sounds like somebody who really knows how to live it up Vulcan style. So
I think so. Well, speaking of Vulcan style, Teresa Adams says that her Trek-centric resolution is to grow pointy ears. Now, I don't know what this involves, but I'm not sure that this is physically possible, Teresa.
I don't know if you can grow them. You can definitely have a procedure done if you're really dead set on having pointy ears. I know a couple people who've had it done. I don't personally recommend it, though.
No, I wouldn't do that. And one more from here before I ask you about yours. because this one sounds like it might actually be yours. This is from Kyle C. Booz, and he says his is to hang with green chicks.
Yes, that sounds like it is something I would say, doesn't it?
I think so. So what is your Trek-centric resolution, Greg?
My Trek-centric, well, it's nothing as fancy as those. I would just say it would be in finishing watching, you know, this cycle of the Star Trek series. You know, I just watched TNG and DS9, and I'm about to finish Enterprise. So I just have to watch Voyager and TOS, and I will have watched all of Star Trek in about 1 year's time. So I'm getting really close to it, and then I can start, you know, all over again with TNG in HD.
That's right. Yeah, that's quite a feat. You have to really be persistent and focused, I would say, to get through all of Star Trek in 1 year. That's something.
Yeah, it requires several episodes per night and a lot of endurance of getting through several first and second seasons.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I'm like that. Even though DS9 is my favorite series, some of the first season stuff in particular takes me a little bit of effort to get through.
Yeah.
Yeah, for
sure. Although once it's in HD, at least I'll be able to marvel at the sets and production design and all of that. Watching it in fuzzy Netflix is not the greatest experience when the story is kind of lackluster.
Yeah, that's true. I guess my resolution is going to be to make it to Star Trek Las Vegas this August. It's something that I have not been able to do in the past, and I really want to be there this year, both for myself and for Trek FM, so I'm going to find a way to make that happen.
I really do hope that happens. It'd be great to have you here in the States. I'm hoping to make it to Las Vegas as well. And Star Trek Boston, I'm looking at as well. We'll see what ends up happening. But definitely, I hope you can make it to the States and meet a lot of our listeners and friends on Twitter.
Now, speaking of Trek FM having a presence at Star Trek Las Vegas, which I hope we do, we were given an award by the site X*Scientia. Yesterday, actually, I got the news, and this is a very long-running Star Trek site that goes all the way back to 1998, and they have been giving out this award every month to honor the best Star Trek websites since 1999, and they actually did it monthly all the way through 2008, but as they point out these days, there are a lot fewer Star Trek websites. You know, the numbers have dwindled and dwindled and dwindled, and of course, starting in 1998 means they came in after that period in the 90s where Paramount came in and kind of shut down all the fan activity that was going
right.
on. But we have received this honor for, as he puts it, combining the best of both worlds, which he calls Web 2.0, and kind of personal fan swarm intelligence.
That sounds about right.
And X*Scientia is run by Bernd Schneider, mm-hmm. who's a very dedicated fan, and he really appreciates that we offer a variety of podcasts, videos, articles, news, what he calls much more like a traditional personal Star Trek site, but yet we accomplish it in this very prolific community environment that we've built around Trek FM.
So, I really appreciated seeing that he gave us this award. It really means a lot to me that people are looking at the site and saying this really deserves recognition. You know, I came to Trek FM and I was just amazed, and this was before we had so many podcasts and articles. I was just amazed with the design of the site itself and the scope of what you were trying to accomplish with it.
It's been an experience growing it. Yeah, it started out very small and it has really exploded. And that's thanks to everyone listening to the show, all of our readers. And so we really appreciate it. And this is going to be a great year. He does point out that one difficult thing about our site right now is it's kind of hard to find older content. And I totally agree. And we are working to remedy that. So stay tuned for another great year. But Bernd, thanks so much for the award. We really appreciate it. Well, moving on our last show, Greg, we talked about the console game, and I said I had pre-ordered, mm-hmm. and we had a little bit of
mixed signals between StarTrek.com and Amazon on the release date. And it turns out that StarTrek.com was right, and Amazon had the old information, and I received an email update about my order the other day.
What is the actual release date going to be then?
Well, the interesting point is that the email I got didn't tell me the release date, but it did tell me the estimated arrival date, which is between April 25th and April 29th. So I believe the release date is April 23rd. I think that's what StarTrek.com had said originally, right?
That sounds right. April sounds like much more of a correct release date. Considering it's going to be a tie-in for the movie, late April sounds good. I'm still hoping that doesn't get missed. I always hate it when these tie-in games come out like 6 months after the movie and they lose all of that good. And then even though it was 6 months late, it still, you know, has game-stopping bugs and, you know, just it's not very good. I'm hoping that they have worked on this, you know, far enough in advance that they're going to really have the game solidly ready for release around that time.
They really should. I mean, they showed this at E3 back in 2011, wasn't it? Summer 2011?
Yeah. Right.
So, and of course, at that point, they had to be working on it for quite a while. So they've got like a good 2+ years development on this. So,
yeah, it does. I mean, at that time, they had, you know, it wasn't playable, I think, in 2011, but they did have video. They showed it working. It sounded like they had the game figured out. Now they're talking about bonus content that you can get with a pre-order. Sounds like it's on its way.
I think it is. So that's April 23rd, it seems, release date, not March 31st, as Amazon had told me originally.
There we go.
So that's just a quick update to let everyone know what's happening with the release of the game. Now, Greg, tell me, what were you doing on January 3rd, 1993?
I can't tell you exactly, as I'm not sure. Maybe I was being read The Hobbit before being sent to bed early, so my parents could watch Emissary by themselves and decide that it was not going to be something that their children were going to watch.
Right, so this past week, beginning January 3rd, marked the 20th anniversary of the premiere of Deep Space Nine. And I say beginning January 3rd because as a syndicated show, this premiered, Emissary premiered on different nights in different markets. So not everyone got it on the 3rd. But if I remember correctly, we did get it on the 3rd. That sounds right to me, January 3rd. I remember I was in university. My roommate, Sasha, who was a Russian exchange student we had at the university that year, we sat down together. I managed to get the TV away from him and his constant viewing of MacGyver and Quantum Leap to watch the premiere of Deep Space Nine. And it was quite an experience. It was, you know, really a different show, but I like the way they tied it into The Next Generation. And one thing I remember was the build-up to it, and then I remember the news stories about how people were gathering in Birmingham in bars, you know, all around the city to get together to watch the premiere of DS9.
Was it what you were expecting? Like, how were they selling it before it came out? Was it just more Next Generation? Were they selling it as a more wider audience kind of Star Trek?
What I remember was a lot of the build-up, the talk was about how it was, as we've talked about many times on here, that darker, grittier take on Star Trek. And I don't remember it being sold as any kind of continuation of TNG, personally. But, of course, they did a good job of tying, I think, you know, using Wolf 359 as the connection to Picard and making this relationship between Sisko and Picard, I thought was a fantastic move to bring in the Next Generation fans, kind of get them interested. And, you know, the premiere was extremely successful. And of course, the numbers kind of waned a little bit
right
after that. But, Yeah, I remember it just as, you know, it was really an unknown. I mean, everyone was surprised that The Next Generation had been so successful as a spinoff of Star Trek. And then the idea of doing another spinoff was just kind of unheard of at the time. And
yeah, I'm constantly surprised that they did it at all. I mean, we've seen it done before where you have a spinoff, then you have another one right afterwards. But the fact that we did have two Star Trek shows running as early as 1993 is really impressive. And that does speak to how good TNG was at that point. It had had several good years under its belt, and I think they were feeling really strong about the property. I do wish that they'd done more with the Picard-Sisko rivalry. Like, you know, maybe when they have the baseball episode, that could have been Picard coming back, and they have to fight against the Enterprise crew.
So you want, in the last season, Take Me Out to the Holosuite, you wanted it to be the Enterprise crew versus the Deep Space Nine crew?
I think that would have been great. As they're practicing, you've got Patrick Stewart sitting on the back in the bleachers, watching them warily, scouting them out.
What if they had done a storyline where the leader of the Cardassian government was actually a clone of Picard?
Ooh, I like this idea. I like this idea a lot. Sure. Just put them right up next to each other. Bring Tom Hardy on the show. That'd be great.
So throughout the entire series, it would be this face-off between Sisko and clone Picard, who they would call Gull Picard.
Gull Picard. Well, they had evil Riker, you know, who takes off the beard parts of his beard and makes it an evil Thomas Riker goatee. I think they should have had, sure, evil Picard, evil Troy could have showed up. Evil Wesley Crusher? Well, why not?
Evil Dr. Pulaski. That's what I want to see.
Well, she starts out as evil, so I think she could have just come on DS9 and really shooken things up.
Just as herself.
Yes.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Yeah, that would work for me. But it's hard for me to believe that it's been 20 years since DS9 premiered. I remember it so well, you know, happening. And wow, I'm glad to see that the series is gaining a lot of appreciation. And the other thing, a lot of columns, of course, have been written this week about DS9's yeah. anniversary. Jordan Hoffman wrote one for StarTrek.com in his One Trek Mind column. And Larry wrote one for his Trekland blog. And very interestingly, two things. There's a photo, Larry calls it the mystery photo, from when they were building the set, and it's actually the promenade, but it's still wood. They're putting together the framework of the promenade with wood. It's a very interesting photo when you look at that and then think about how the promenade looks on the show.
Yeah, I think all of the photos, Larry sort of feels like he went back into his archives and found a whole bunch of photos and everything. I hope people do go through the link to look at Larry's blog and look at those pictures he's been posting there and also on Twitter. Doug Drexler as well has been going through his archives to find some old pictures. Really cool stuff. I'm glad to see DS9 getting some recognition after we had, you know, last year was a very big TNG year. I'd love to see people really remembering DS9 a lot more this year.
On Larry's blog also, he has a video with Ira, and it's, I think, the fourth part of a series that he did. And it's very interesting in the beginning where Ira really talks candidly about the experience of being on DS9. And he says that, you know, people ask him about it and they think that maybe he's going to say that as time goes on, you know, DS9 becomes less important to him because, you know, he's gone on to other things and such, but he talks about how special that experience was and how he knew in the moment that he was there how special the experience was. Because, you know, often you do things and it's only later when you look back at them that you realize that you were doing something great or it was a special time in your life. But he talks about how unique that was to have the freedom that the studio gave them, to have all those, the sets and the resources available to tell that story. And he told the writers at the time to, you know, enjoy this because it's never going to be like this again. And I think that speaks to how unique and special Deep Space Nine is, that especially when you look at the later series like Voyager, where you did have the studio hand guiding what was going on, and the writers didn't have that kind of freedom that you see on Deep Space Nine. So it was a really, I would say, 20 years ago this week is started a very special period in Star Trek's history.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, And you're reminding me how much I wish that Star Trek had stayed syndicated and stayed independent, because it is a lot of what led to DS9 being such a different show. And it would have been great to see other different types of Star Trek shows rather than Voyager, which just felt so much more of a typical Star Trek show that you felt the network's hand in.
Yeah, it really would have been. And I think Voyager would have been quite different had it been syndicated. Mm. I know I think a lot of listeners think we rag on Voyager a lot, but yeah, I mean, when you watched it in first run, and especially when you had Deep Space Nine's later seasons running simultaneously mm-hmm. with the early seasons of Voyager, it was really hard to watch that and not feel that difference in creative freedom and that difference in depth between those two shows, and make you wonder, like, what would have happened in those early seasons of Voyager had the writing staff had the freedom that the DS9 writing staff had.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I did want to ask you, you know, Larry talks about the pendulum shifting from Star Trek to TNG and back again and then back again. When do you think we'll see that pendulum take a swing we've never seen it really take before, where it swings over to DS9? Is that going to take till the 25th anniversary and the Blu-rays start coming out? What's it going to take for DS9 to really start getting that recognition?
I don't know. I kind of think that will never happen. I think that DS9, as many people... I think that DS9 has a very special audience. You know, many people are starting to watch it, many of them for the first time. They're really starting to appreciate it. But I still think in the overall Star Trek fan community, there's always TOS and there's always TNG. And that's where the bulk of the fan base is. And then for DS9, for Voyager, for Enterprise, you have these groups within the fan community who love these particular shows. But I think almost everyone universally loves The Next Generation. And
right.
I won't say everyone universally today loves the original series, because it's been so long since it was on that people like me who grew up with it are getting older. There are a lot of younger people who have never even watched the original series, or they've only seen it in the remastered version, or they just feel like they can't connect with the stories because the method of storytelling and the production right. value and all just doesn't connect with the modern audience as much. But if you take the JJ take on TOS, if you include that and you bring in those younger people, I still think it bounces between Kirk, Spock and their crew, yep. and then Picard, Riker, Data and their crew. And yeah. And I don't think you'll ever see like a huge swing towards any of the other series.
Hmm. Well, unless, of course, you put up a poll on StarTrek.com about what show's 20th anniversary are you most looking forward to, then, of course, everyone says Voyager.
Everyone will say Voyager. Voyager will win that poll.
Even That's if it's right. what anniversary this year, they'll still say Voyager, but it's only 18 years. Voyager! Okay.
I know. It'll be a question like... With which captain would you most like to sit down in their ready room and drink a cup of hot Earl Grey tea? And they'll say, Captain Janeway! Right?
They will, yes. Which captain would you rather have fight against the Gorn, you know, on Cestus III in the 23rd century? And they'll still say, Captain Janeway!
Right. There'll be some time travel story that gets her there. Some sort of switch. She switches places with Kirk. She has to fight the Gorn. Meanwhile, Kirk is on Voyager doing something in an episode that wasn't shot.
Well, he's doing that classic episode of Voyager where the Andorian comes aboard and fights everyone.
take your blood to Andorra.
Oh, I love that episode. I was really impressed, actually, being lost in the Delta Quadrant. The fact that they were able to work an Andorian fight scene into each episode was astonishing, because there were really not a lot of Andorians around.
Well, I mean, I understand that we usually see Jeffrey Combs either in the Alpha Quadrant or the Beta Quadrant, but he's also in the Delta Quadrant.
He is everywhere.
He really is. All right. Well, at any rate, happy birthday to Deep Space Nine, a show that added just a great amount of depth to the Star Trek universe. I'm really, really glad that that show was created and that Ira and everyone involved had the freedom to tell an amazing story.
And if you're watching it on Netflix and you're stuck on the first two seasons, just keep going. Keep going. I promise you, like, the moment, it's at least when the fourth season starts, you'll be hooked. But I think even by the third season, you'll be pretty much hooked.
Yeah, but there's some good episodes in all of that, too.
Oh,
you
absolutely.
Know, actually, in the hands of the prophets, the last episode of the first season, Okay, that was 20 years ago. You watch that now, it's exactly the struggle that's taking place in the United States, especially in the South, right now, between teaching the world based on science and teaching the world based on religion. It's right there with, at this point, Vedic win and Keiko O'Brien, of all people. And it's actually a really good story, and it's right there at the end of the first season.
That's absolutely true. I think, once you get there and then the beginning of season two, that's a great place where you just feel like they're starting to really pick up steam. So just keep at it. I'd never tell anyone to skip the first two seasons, because there's a ton of great stuff in there.
Absolutely. All right, Greg. Well, let's take a break for just a moment from news to say thank you to our sponsor, Squarespace.
Well, yes, and you did receive this award this week that we talked about earlier in news, and I think a lot of it comes from the freedom you had building Trek FM in Squarespace to build a site that's really easy to get around in. There's a lot of stuff you can get to. It's this really powerful website that you created using Squarespace.
That's true. That's a good point. Squarespace made it very easy for me to build Trek FM, which is a very large, as everyone knows who's visited, a very large website with so many different sections to the site. And maybe today what we could talk about quickly here is building a large website with Squarespace. Mm-hmm. Because the back end, if you've ever tried to build a website, a large website, using a tool like Dreamweaver, you know, it's very much up to you to create a structure for the site and a filing system, and kind of there are a lot of pieces that you have together. You're almost like a cattle herder, you know, pulling all the pieces together, and it can be quite challenging. Squarespace, on the other hand, what's really cool, let's say you're on your website, you're building your website in Squarespace, and you want to manage the content on your site, the sections on your site, this is really cool. You just hit the escape key on your keyboard, and it actually takes you to the back end of the website, where you have all the tools you need to build sections, to organize your navigation, even set permissions for your editors, for your users. It's so easy. They give you a column, and you can just add a page, and you can add an HTML page, you can add a journal, which, if you think about WordPress, you know, WordPress is basically a blog, and in Squarespace terminology, I call it a journal. And within a Squarespace site, you can have many, many, many journals, which is what we have on Trek FM, and every one of those has automatically set up RSS feeds, and you add entries the same way you would do on, say, a WordPress site, only it's like you can have many, many WordPress sites within a single large website, and it makes management so easy. So you can create an HTML page, you can create a journal, you can create just a link to another section or an external site, photo galleries, and then you can just drag them in your browser to arrange your navigation. You can nest them very easily to create entire sections of websites. It's amazing how simple it is.
And one thing that I want to mention about Squarespace that I really like is how they're constantly improving it. You know, there's some other sites out there where you create stuff, and yes, they have updates, but half the time the updates just break what you've already built, or they didn't add anything that you'd actually want to use. You know, when Squarespace comes out with Squarespace 5 and then Squarespace 6, they've added a ton of new tools and things you can do to make your site better. They're not just sitting back and making money off of what they built 5-10 years ago.
That's very true. They are constantly improving the site. I've been using Squarespace for, I don't know, maybe like 5 years now, 4 or 5 years. It actually has been about that long. I didn't realize it's been that long, but time really flies. And I've seen constant improvements. And you mentioned how, say, with a site like WordPress, a system like WordPress, where you're adding all these third-party extensions on, and then you get an update to WordPress, and you need to install it because it's important from a security standpoint. But then you install it, and then it breaks something that's critical to your site, and you have to wait for that developer to catch up. And sometimes by the time they catch up, then WordPress puts out another update, and you're like caught in this cycle. One of the great things about Squarespace is that all of these modules, all these capabilities, they're all coming from Squarespace. So you never have to worry about an update to the platform itself breaking the tools that make your site special. And that's very, very important.
Yeah. And that's whether you're making a blog of some sort or you're making a real website. You know, part of my problem also with these other engines is you want to make a, quote, real website and it looks like a blog. This lets you make whatever you want it to look like, whether you want it just to be a list of articles, whether you want to have a bunch of different sections, whether you're trying to put podcasts, video podcasts, articles, reviews, all of these different things together. Squarespace lets you make one site that lets people navigate between all of it.
And speaking of podcasts, if you've tried to, you know, set up your RSS feeds before to get a podcast in iTunes and distribute, you honestly won't find any simpler solution than Squarespace. It's all built right into the pages. It makes our life at Trek FM so much easier. I actually couldn't imagine putting 10 shows out every week, doing it all manually, you know, without those tools there. So excellent, excellent platform. And we'd like to invite you to try it free for 14 days. And the pricing is really cheap, Greg. It's $8 for the basic package, which meets the needs of most people, or $16 per month for the unlimited package. And if you do that annually, they'll actually give you a free domain name registration as well.
That's fantastic. What is that URL they want to go to?
So just go to squarespace.com/trek, and that will get you in through our path. And then if you decide to stick with Squarespace, you can use code TREK1, and that will get you 10% off lifetime for your purchase on Squarespace. So again, that's squarespace.com/trek, and the new code for this month, because it's January, is TREK1. So please go try it out. You'll absolutely love it, I promise you. And you'll be supporting our sponsor, Squarespace, and Trek FM at the same time. Well, Greg, what's going on here? It looks like our transmission has been hijacked from somewhere in deep space, possibly from somewhere in the darkness. Is that Larry Nemechek?
I think
that has broken into the show here.
I think so. He seems to be surrounded by every bit of Star Trek lore. There he is. Oh wait, no, that's Darth Vader, who has now entered our podcast.
It is your destiny.
Every bit of Star Trek lore. The left pinky, the right knuckle. What does that mean?
I don't know.
It looks like it is in fact Larry. And Larry, who is that you have with you there?
Oh, it's that little thing that tagged around after Scotty and JJ's movie. Oh no, it's not Keenzer. It's it's Terrace.
Well, hello. I'm in. How are you guys?
But Keenzer was from Canada, right? Oh no, wait. Okay. Hi, Terrace.
You should have said from Canada, A.
That's right. As opposed to Canada B, which, as we all knew, blew up about 40 years ago. Okay.
Hello, Terrace. Welcome back to the Ready Room. So,
thank you.
So, guys, tell me, we were just in the middle of talking about Star Trek news here. Why are you guys hijacking our transmission?
It's a pretty boring Sunday, and I had nothing else to do. No, actually, time is short. Time is short. We're doing another tour, Terrace will tell you, and I'll tell you, in 2013, the Hollywood to Vegas tour before the Vegas convention.
Yeah, so we're running the tour for 2013, and we've got some new destinations worked into it. We're really excited about it, and Larry's going to be on the tour again to fill us with Star Trek goodness. And we're going to a lot of cool new destinations. We've got lots for everybody. We've got a whole bunch of people backing the tour this year, a lot of sponsors, so to speak. As for destinations, we're going to go to Jake Sisko's restaurant. We're going to end up first day, we're going to start to celebrate Deep Space Nine's anniversary and go straight into Sir Rick Lofton's restaurant.
Tara, speaking of DS9, it sounds like the Breen are jamming your phone or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
They're hijacking our hijacking or something.
Am I stuttering, or is it just because...
No. Maybe you should, like, move one of those mountains in the Canadian Rockies out of the way or something.
Yeah. You better watch out. You know, sometimes those jammings of transmissions, they're a prelude to an Andorian jumping out and attacking you.
You have the first move.
No blueness around. My wife is having a shower. I hope that she might put some makeup on or something like that later.
Some blue makeup and some antenna.
Actually, that's part of the new tour, is Terrace's wife in blue makeup jumping out from behind mountains. No, actually, we had a... You know, last year was the Shakedown cruise for the tour that we planned, and it was designed to lead into the Vegas convention. So apart from all the great bonuses, which I know we've droned on and on about, it's a great way to see stuff. It's a great way to see Trek things in a group. It's a great way to see LA and surrounding, you know, geography and tourist sites. And it's a great way to hit the Vegas convention, whether you've gone before or you're a total virgin about going. And this year we're just making some tweaks and keeping the best of last year and some new things like he mentioned, going down to Sir Rick Lofton's restaurant. So, you know, Jerry Ryan's not the only one with a restaurant in LA. And the other thing Terrace was trying to get to was the Valley of Fire. People kept asking us why we didn't go to the Valley of Fire in Nevada, where, you know, Kirk died in Generations. And it's because it was on the other side of Vegas, but we, you know, Terrace realized, well, why don't we just go to Vegas a night early and then get up on Wednesday and then go out to Valley of Fire and come back on Wednesday night, and then bang, it starts Thursday. Or at least I thought that was your thinking, Terrace?
Yeah, that's exactly it. No, you just can't do it, Larry, really.
I know.
Give up. Wanted to do something really iconic in and around Vegas. And, of course, the Valley of Fire is known for lots of other stuff other than Star Trek, too. It's kind of a spiritual center for Native Americans. And we'll see really cool artifacts that kind of stuff, but we're also going to see where he died, and we're actually going to have pictures on the bridge. The bridge is still there, apparently, and they use it from crossing over to one side of kind of a cliff face to another. And so we'll get some really good photos and maybe some action scenes of Larry trying to kill people and go from
well,
there.
Well, if you pay extra, you can be kicked off the side of the mountain on the bridge.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Can I get a picture of Larry trying to crawl through a gap in the rocks?
We could do that, actually. You know, what we're also actually doing is...
Where the hell did that come from? Okay.
We're actually always also going to be getting a whole bunch of props.
You're making fun of my Are you making fun of my reviews of David Goodman's book about being gap filling? Was that where that came from?
Wow, that's deep. No, I just watched Generations, and I was trying to think of scenes I would like you to reenact.
Okay. Okay.
Wow, Larry, you should have got that right away. I'm surprised.
Okay. It's a busy day. Busy week, busy month, busy night. Busy 10 minutes. Yeah. Okay.
we're gonna have props actually at each place that we go to this year. So when we go Bobby Clark at Vasquez, we'll have a Gorn Rock and Captain Kirk's cannon, and maybe we'll have something for the Valley of Fires.
Not to take it totally away from the poor host there, but tell them real quick, Terrace, about the sponsors that we didn't have last year that we got this year.
Oh, yeah. So
with goodies. Goodie sponsors.
Yeah, we sure do, actually. And Larry, I've got a new one since we talked last. So,
ooh, goodie.
Yeah, Entertainment, they're giving us $50 off purchases over $200 or more. So they're
Creation, you said. I think you got jammed again. Yeah. Creation.
Yeah, Creation Entertainment. Sorry about that. Yeah. Robe Factory is giving us a nice a towel each. So and they have some more promotions for us in the next little bit also. And Bye Bye Robot, we're getting some stickers, some Star Trek stickers from them. And our new guy is Stronghold Games. I don't know if you guys know about it, but there's a board game called Space Cadets where you try to be different stations on the bridge of a non-IP infringing spaceship. So check that out, actually. if you want to go to that, if you want to take a look at those sponsors, that we'd really appreciate it. But so we're really happy about that also.
That's interesting.
That sounds great. So if people want to sign up for the tour, where should they go?
Yeah, so just go to geeknationtours.com, go to our upcoming tours, and you'll see the Star Trek tour right there. Easy. There's a smiley, yellow smiley with some pointed ears. And read the tour. Send us in your sign-up sheet. You know, there's no money down. We'd like to talk to you, make sure everybody you know what's going on the tour, and get excited about the tour, and then we can worry about a deposit then. So, check us out.
You have to pass Sheldon and Leonard's top 10 trivia questions to be able to go on the tour. So, no, I just made that up.
Okay, that sounds excellent. Well, we will have you back to talk a little bit more about it as you know get closer on the network here and get some more details out to everyone.
Seriously, thank you, Chris, because last year we didn't announce the first one until March, and it kind of cut, I know, a lot of people off, right. So we've been trying to talk about it, or, you know, Christmas and holidays, and let people, you know, save their pennies and get in.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Well, you know, it's tough to get word out when you've got the Breen jamming your signal all the time, so I'm glad we were able to cut through that. All right. Well, Terrace, thanks so much for coming on. And
thank you. No, that was awesome. It was always great to see you guys.
We wish you Godspeed as you make your way through Breen space there, and hope to see you on the other side.
So the next thing I wanted us to talk about on today's show is the new thing that is coming from the mind of William Shatner. He just does not seem to ever stop, apparently.
He really doesn't.
Which is fine. That's fine with me. He keeps making these documentaries that people really enjoy, and he seems to have so much fun making them. It seems to be his life now is to go around with cameras and make documentaries. His next one is getting away from what I think is his norm, which is usually focusing on, you know, his life or Star Trek, the original series. This one's actually going to focus on the birth and life of the Next Generation.
It is. I was interested to see this because, like you said, he's typically focused on the original series. I know in the Captains, you know, he talked to Patrick Stewart and Avery Brooks and Kate Mulgrew and Scott Bakula and even Chris Pine. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was a cool move because it would have been easy for him to just skip over Chris Pine as, you know, Kirk Light or something like that. But
right.
But he brought him in. He has I think, warmed up to the larger Star Trek universe in recent years. You know, I feel like he is covering Star Trek as a whole a lot more and isn't so much about the Kirk as superhero kind of approach that we saw in some of the novels, you know, that he wrote with Judith N'Gar and such. But, you know, his documentaries have been really good. And I feel like everything he's done in recent years, for me anyway, has been really good. You know, his TV shows, being on Boston Legal, his stage show, Shatner's World, the albums, especially Has-Been with Ben Folds, was just brilliant. We talked about, before Seeking Major Tom came out, we talked about it on the show, and I said I was really skeptical about that album. Mm-hmm. And then it came out, and I listened to it, and it was fantastic. So this guy is, he just never stops, like you said.
And I mean, right now he's on tour. He's got his one-man show that's going to pretty much every city in America except Seattle. And I'm hearing it's good. I won't be able to see it. But he's doing that at the same time that he's prepping this documentary, which apparently has the working title Wacky Doodle.
I have a feeling that's not going to be the final title of the documentary.
Maybe they'll go with Wacky Doodle Into Darkness. I hear that's what they're thinking of. They're beta testing a few different names, though.
It could be. Oh, well, they asked him, it was the Chicago Sun-Times who interviewed mm-hmm. him, and they asked him about this documentary. And in a nutshell, he said, it's about how crazy it was, how difficult it was to get it started and do it right. So it sounds like he's probably going to be approaching it from the perspective of the success of the original series and, you know, that old phrase that it's hard to capture lightning twice. Mm. And
right.
But they succeeded. And so looking at that, and he is going to be focusing on the first couple of seasons. So I have a feeling that that's probably the angle that he's taking.
I hope he really digs in deep and answers some of those long-running secrets, like why command and security switched colors going into TNG.
Well, isn't that because of Patrick Stewart didn't look good in gold?
Is that the answer? I had heard it was that Roddenberry was trying to get away from the red shirt jokes.
I've heard that too. Yeah, I've heard that too. But I don't know. I liked the fact that Enterprise went back to the original gold and red.
Yeah.
However, I really prefer red for command, because red, the strength of the color, the meaning of the color, for me, it is more appropriate. I think that might also be why I like the original series movie uniforms.
I could definitely see that. I wouldn't want to see, I wouldn't want to see Picard and Riker in yellow or gold as it is. I like the way the color scheme worked in Next Gen. I miss the look of those old uniforms. You know, Kirk didn't just wear gold. He also wore green from time to time. They were a little bit more loose with the color scheme.
Well, don't forget that Picard wore kind of storm cloud grayish blue also. He had his special uniform as well.
That is true. I liked that. It was the Darmok uniform that continued, right? Yeah.
And he had a jacket that he wore quite a lot. And I always wanted that jacket, by the way.
I love Picard's fancy jacket. I wish they'd done that more. And I wish that Brooks had gotten something similar. They end up putting him in that first contact vest a little bit, which is fun. But,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But he never got anything in particular. Anyway, I'm sure Shatner won't be focusing too much on the uniforms. That's just one
of my
my pet peeves. It was watching Next Gen. It's like, but the colors, that's not correct at all. But as you say, they do look good in red.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. So that's coming up. They also asked him what he thought about J.J. Abrams and the 2009 Star Trek film, as well as Star Trek Into Darkness. And what did he have to say about J.J.?
Well, I think he said that J.J. is a hack. It should never be allowed near Star Trek ever again. And that he's boycotting. I don't think that's what he said.
No, I don't think that's what he said, Greg.
He had some very nice things to say. He said that what J.J. Abrams has done is really wonderful. He's opened the field to a much larger audience. Perhaps if he does more, he will come to the idea that Star Trek is also a wondrous story and not just a ride of derring-do. So it does sound like he shares our opinion that the first film was wonderful, but a little light on Star Trek. You know, what really we love about Star Trek, which is the stories. So we'll see what happens with Into Darkness and if it does make it more of that, you know, heavy, introspective Star Trek. But in general, I don't think anyone can say that they're not really fun films to watch. And the fact that it's bringing Star Trek to so many other people, you know, I don't think that Shatner would be able to be making these documentaries and do his one-man show if the JJ film hadn't brought Star Trek back into the mainstream again.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we'll find out what happens with that and what happens with Wacky Doodle as he gets closer to putting that together. All right, Greg, one more update we have on what we talked about on the last show. We mentioned that Brandon Braga had asked fans on Twitter to make their suggestions on what they would like to see as extras on the Enterprise Blu-ray sets. And now I found out from TrekNews.net who got word from TrekCore. Three of the special bonus features from the Season 1 Blu-ray have been announced.
Right, and I think mainly these just come from what Brandon has said in his Twitter feed are things that are coming. But yes, we have heard, as I mentioned, that Dominic Keating and Connor Trenier recorded an audio commentary for Shuttlepod 1. That should be very cool. They're doing documentaries on each of the sets. Well, it's going to be a three-part documentary. So about the making of Enterprise, which is similar to what they've been doing with TNG. As well as a special candid discussion feature with Rick Berman and Brandon Braga entitled In Conversation. So I'm assuming they'll be talking about what mistakes they may or may not have made over the course of the series, but things that they like as well. I'd love to hear a candid discussion. You know, one of my favorite commentaries was the one that Braga and Moore did about Generations, where they talk about the process of writing that script and things they wish they could have done better, but things that they actually really do like about it as well.
That is an excellent commentary. I like all the commentaries with Braga and Moore together because they give you great insight into their creative process, but they're also critical of themselves as well. So it's very, very, very interesting from a creative standpoint. I'm glad that Connor Trenier and Dominic Keating recorded a commentary for Shuttlepod 1, which is, I think, is a great episode, but it's the kind of episode that makes a lot of people hate the first season of Enterprise because they're stuck in a shuttlepod the whole time talking to each other and cuddled up with blankets. But what I would have rather seen here would have been a commentary for Shuttlepod 1 that was Linda Park and Jolene Blaylock making fun of Connor Trenier and Dominic Keating, two guys stuck in the small space together with one blanket.
That could have been quite interesting. I'm interested to hear what other commentaries they do as well. Yeah, as we talked about, I hope there's commentaries on each episode, and if they're bringing the actors in, that's great, especially when it is so actor centric, as in this one.
Yeah, this one is a great one for the actors. As we said last week, I believe, I really wish they were recording commentaries for every episode and that most of them were with Braga or other writers. Of course, in the early Enterprise seasons, it's pretty much Berman and Braga making sure they had control over all the stories. But I would love to hear the behind-the-scenes thought process behind every episode. Yeah.
Well, and once we get to the fourth season especially, I'd really like to hear Judith and Garfield, Reese Stevens, do commentaries on the Vulcan arc and that sort of thing.
Yeah. If that doesn't happen, CBS has completely missed the boat.
Yeah.
Seriously. If there is no Judith and Garfield, Reese Stevens commentary for that Vulcan trilogy, I'm going to boycott the discs. I don't know what I'm going to do.
There you go. Well, we do need We do need to make sure we go out and buy these Enterprise Blu-rays to make sure that they really put the effort into the later seasons.
Yeah.
I'd hate to see just a very basic season 4 set come out because seasons 1 through 3 got lackluster sales.
Yeah. So if you are an Enterprise fan, make sure that you pick these up. And if you're not an Enterprise fan yet, pick them
Shame
up anyway
on you.
And watch them because it's really a great series. Don't listen to all the naysayers who just like to hate on Enterprise because it's kind of like the cool thing to do. Watch it. It is a very good series. Okay, Greg, as we move into movie news and rumors, it looks like we've got some more of our favorite girls on film. Now, did you see this new shot from the movie with Alice Eve and Kirk?
Are those the girls, Alice Eve and Chris Pine?
Yes. No, Alice Eve is one. There's also a great new photo of Zoe.
Yes, and it's an action shot with Zoe Saldana as Uhura. The one we got... I don't know, I was hoping for a better shot of, now I've lost track, is she Elizabeth? No, she's Carol Marcus. I was hoping for a better shot of Carol Marcus, like a nice hero shot, but instead we just get her head in the corner in a picture of Chris Pine, but it's coming along. But we got a bunch of pictures. They released a bunch of high quality pictures on Facebook, and then I think TrekNews.net got the high quality versions of them.
TrekNews.net has some much higher resolution ones compared to the ones on StarTrek.com.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite of the ones so far that we've gotten is the shot with, as I say, Pine and Pike, but it's Kirk and Pike sort of sitting down, facing each other, having what looks to be a very intense conversation. And it's probably, I'm assuming, where that speech Pike gives in the trailer, where he talks about Kirk not having an ounce of humility. He's going to, you know, get his whole crew detonated and everything they stand for. It looks like it's going to be a great scene. And this image is a really powerful one. I've actually set it as my cover photo in Twitter. I don't know if anyone ever looks at cover photos in Twitter, but it's in there now.
Yeah, I don't look at them very often. But either that's going on in the scene or they're having a staring contest, one or the other.
Well, that could be. Maybe it's the alternate opening to the film where they're just goofing off together, having a staring contest. Maybe they'll play some rock, paper, scissors, Jenga.
Well, they're going to do rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock. That's yes. What, of course. I mean, you got to have that in there.
You wouldn't believe how long The Big Bang Theory has stayed in syndication.
Yeah, right. All the way to the 23rd century, right? That's what Kirk rips off his jacket, and he's got that same shirt that I have with the rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock diagram on it.
That's what he's wearing under that black uniform, yeah.
That's right, yeah. There's a new shot of Spock, which actually looks like it came straight out of the console video game that we've been talking about.
Yeah, it really looks like they're bumping up the action quotient in this film. Let's really give Spock... He's got a rifle in this one, right? I know he does on the cover of the Star Trek game.
I'm sure.
I think in this one, he's just got the pistol, but I've seen another image of him with a rifle.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is probably... Is this from Kronos? It looks like this is where they're going around Kronos hunting for John Harrison, in quotation marks. Looks to be some really cool action scenes that are coming up in this film.
Could be. Yeah. So, yeah, speaking of Cumberbatch there, there's a shot here of Sherlock wearing a Starfleet uniform holding a pistol.
It's a very... You can't really tell from the picture too well, but what it shows looks like a very pistol-looking pistol. It doesn't look like a space-age phaser very much. It looks like he's just holding a Glock or something.
Maybe, although it looks like the same one that Spock is holding.
Right, which also looks like it's something that James Bond would carry more than Jim Kirk.
Yeah, it really does. There's a shot of Spock in the volcano, maybe the best view that we've had of, because you can actually see Spock's face inside the helmet, which is nice.
And of course, we did see that on Nibiru in the IMAX preview. We saw quite a bit of Spock in the volcano, but here's an image that people can latch onto. But pretty much, the whole scene, it looks like that.
and people like me who can't see the IMAX.
Can't see it, right?
So, the last thing that I'll mention out of these is there's an interesting shot here of Simon Pegg wearing a very unusual jacket, but it has the little red up on the shoulders. So it's an interesting new take on that designation, I guess I would say, in a JJ uniform design.
And I wonder if it's the more of like a hazmat suit like they had in the original series films. You'd see Scotty and his crew not really wearing the traditional uniforms down there. So I wonder if this is like that. I really do like the little triangular cutout with the color in there.
That looks very cool. So if you want to take a look at these, if you haven't seen them yet, I would recommend going over to treknews.net because you can see the larger photos there, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. There was a heartwarming story, Greg, since it actually happened at the end of December, but it was after we recorded our last show. There's a terminally ill fan whose last wish, it's really sad. I mean, you know, I'm 40, this person's 41, 1 year older than me, diagnosed with terminal cancer. And his last wish was to see Into Darkness before he died. But he only has a few weeks left to live. He's not going to make it until May 17th. So his wife took to Reddit and posted to try to get the attention of JJ to find a way to allow her husband to see this movie, you know, before everyone else gets to see it.
Yeah, a really heartwarming story. I was, you know, when I first saw it, I thought, well, that's, you know, there's really not a good chance that's going to happen. But it looks like Bad Robot got in touch with the family really quickly, rushed them in for a screening of an incomplete, obviously, version of the film, but did get to see it. Of course, over the weekend, he did pass away, which is quite sad. But it's you know, fantastic, at least, that he did manage to see the film. If that was his you know, last wish, it's amazing that they were able to make it happen and actually help him see the film before he died.
It really is. And I think that speaks a lot about J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot, that they were paying attention first and they made that quick arrangement to make that happen. And then one last item we have in movie news today. Empire, the magazine from they're from the UK, right?
Yes, it's a British magazine that I guess they're getting started pretty early with putting Cumberbatch and Pine on the cover, because the film's still not out for a few more months, obviously. And I don't think they're on the cover of Time, or I was going to say Newsweek, but Newsweek isn't around anymore.
Yeah.
But these are some amazing cover images that they put on, and a pretty interesting article inside as well.
Yeah, they really are. The photography, especially the Chris Pine one, is fantastic. Actually, the photography is fantastic on both. The design of the newsstand version, which has all the typography on it, for the Chris Pine cover looks fantastic. The Cumberbatch cover is a little bit too noisy for me, personally, with all this red going on. But the subscriber covers, which only have Star Trek Into Darkness down in the lower corner, otherwise it's a photo with them overlapping the nameplate look beautiful.
Yeah, the Cumberbatch one especially. You know, I showed the picture to somebody and they were like, what have they done with my Cumberbatch? Because, you know, his his head is tilted down a little bit. He's giving that evil stare into the camera. Just the way that the lighting was done, he really, really looks like a bad guy.
He does.
You know, his Sherlock, as sociopathic as Sherlock is at times, he still comes across as a little cuddly. This Harrison looks to be not cuddly at all. And of course, Chris Pine not looking too cuddly himself either, wearing a dark leather coat, which I think that's now official Starfleet issue now that he's joined.
I think so. And he's got that pistol we were talking about in his hand. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So these are some great, great images that they got.
They really are. They really are. So these are really cool covers. Looking for a way to getting English magazines for me requires a trip to special stores.
Right.
And so one reason I said, are these guys from the UK? I was thinking they were from the UK, but because I get it over here, it's like, you know, we get magazines from all over the place. I may look and see if I can't get an iPad version of this. I believe Matthew said there is an iPad Empire app that
you can
subscribe in. So
that would be cool. I mean, I would like to get one of these subscriber covers to put on my wall, but at the very least, I could, you know, get the iPad version and be able to read the article and have the images there.
Hey, and with the high quality HD Retina version, you can take a screenshot and print it out.
There you go.
Yourself. Hang that on your wall.
Just paper my walls with Cumberbatch.
When Star Trek The Motion Picture hit the big screen, it was wonderful to see Kirk and his crew back, but it was really under the guidance of Nicholas Meyer in Star Trek II that kind of the whole modern Star Trek that we know got set into motion. And finally, on the Ready Room, we are going to talk about The Wrath of Khan. It's been a long time coming, and to do it, we have a great panel today. We have back with us, friend of the show, and my fellow victim of Johnny Football, it's Larry Nemechek. Hello, Larry.
You slipped that in on me. Yeah, you know, but, you know, we live and learn and move on. I just am not ready for 3 years of Johnny Football love in the media, but that's okay. I'll deal with it.
Hey, well, think about me. We're in the same division. All right. But also joining us, we have with us today probably the person who knows more than anyone in the world about Space Seed and the Wrath of Khan, and that is John Tenuto. Hello, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having us.
Hey, John.
Welcome.
It's great to have you back with us. And, you know, I've been waiting a long time to do the Wrath of Khan because there was no way that we were going to do the Wrath of Khan without having you on the show. So we're very glad that you're here with us today. For those who don't know, John, you have most people should know, we've covered it over the past year, but you have done so much research into the Nicholas Meyer archives and into Roddenberry's archives, focused specifically on The Wrath of Khan, Space Seed, Ricardo Montalban as well. So hopefully we're going to have some really fascinating insight. People have talked, fans have talked about the movie itself, what's happening on the screen so much. So today we're going to talk about not so much the final product we saw, but how we got that product. And John, you said that you have seen all five of the original script drafts of this movie. So why don't you kick us off with that?
Okay. Well, yeah, the, you know, Star Trek II, I think we're all probably fairly familiar with the origins of it. Harv Bennett, you know, is given the reins to create a sequel, originally planned to be a movie of the week. But I think once confidence was gained by Paramount, they really started to see what was emerging. They eventually moved to a feature film. But the very first sort of written documents for Wrath of Khan was an outline that Harv Bennett did in 1980 called, interestingly, Star Trek II, The War of the Generations, which kind of eventually Generations would be a title, right, of a Star Trek movie. But it wasn't a full script. It was an outline. And in it, Kirk kind of learns of a rebellion on a Federation colony, and he goes there with the intention of seeing what's going on and rescuing Carol Marcus, whose son David, it turns out, is the leader of the rebellion. And then it, as the story goes on, it's kind of the idea is that the true power behind this rebellion, manipulating everything, is Khan. And then David and Kirk join together to defeat Khan. And there's no Spock mentioned at all in that Generation script, which or the Generation's outline, which is kind of interesting. But the very first sort of script, which has a lot of the same beats that we're familiar with, was done by Jack Sowards in 1980, called The Omega System. There's some differences, but if you look at the script, it, at least very broadly, it's got a lot of the Star Trek II that we know. Khan uses spiders in there instead of eels, and Carol Marcus is Dr. Janet Wallace from the Deadly Years. Is that right? Larry, she's Deadly Years, I think. And then Khan has mental powers in that script instead of, in addition to his physical powers. And interestingly, Marla's alive, so really removing the main purpose of the vengeance of Khan. And Savick is in that script, but Savick's a man instead of a woman. And so there's some differences.
Sorry,
there.
Greg.
Yeah, I know.
This is the version where Mike Miner, who was the art director, made the suggestion that, you know, this Omega weapon, that was the point of the story, that the Federation had developed this weapon. It shouldn't be a weapon, that the Federation wouldn't develop, you know, the Death Star, basically. And so he's the one that came up with the idea of it being a terraforming device instead that could be perverted into a weapon by bad guys. And there is a Reliant in that script, but it's a Constitution class. So there's all these little differences. And then the next big draft, or the next big script, was done by Samuel A. Peeples, who, of course, wrote Where No Man Has Gone Before. And in this one, there's no Khan at all. There's actually two villains named Sojin and Moray. Savick is in there, and she's a female, finally. And there's, like, polar bear aliens and a, you know, if you're not familiar with Tron and the little bit that follows, you know, the characters around, and they're saying yes and no, there was kind of a robot like that for Carol Marcus. Named Rubik Cube, I guess. But, and then what happened is Nicholas Meyer took all these, you know, various versions of the script and really transformed them into the Star Trek II that we know. He doesn't receive on-screen writing credit, but right. He really should have, because that script is really his script. And what he did was he took the little pieces, the best pieces of the previous drafts, and then created his unique blend of it, and that's how we got the Star Trek II script, that we know. And really, around September 81 is when he finished the script.
I'm actually surprised to hear that, because there was the Indiana Jones 4 that came out of I think, 4 or 5 scripts that they developed over the years. And they tried to do the same thing, have David Koepp take the best parts. But the film itself feels like a hodgepodge. But watching Wrath of Khan, it doesn't feel that way at all. It feels like this was the idea and they made it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Myers, you know, he's got a lot of talents, but I think, you know, we think of him, well, he's a director, is he a writer, is he a novelist for the 7% Solution and Target Practice and all the different books that he did. But, you know, I think primarily he's a storyteller.
Yeah.
And so because he's a storyteller, he's able to actually work different angles. He can do it as a director, he can do it as a screenplay author. And so, you know, he's just very talented, and I think that... and I think he got Star Trek without getting Star Trek, in the sense that he wasn't a fan of Star Trek, but he understood the heart of it. I think Harve Bennett, you know, deserves a lot of credit too. He understood the heart of what it was. It was about the characters and their relationships with each other. And in some ways, so you had a person come in looking at all these different versions of the scripts that didn't have a idea that somehow Star Trek was sacred, but rather how can you tell a good story, and him recognizing what was good about those previous scripts and what needed to be reworked and changed and moved around. Plus, you know, he had input from the actors and Harve Bennett and then Roddenberry. One of the things that, you know, is in the Myers collection at the University of Iowa is just pages and pages, you know, but 25-30 pages of Roddenberry memos making suggestions about the script.
Now, are any of those early scripts like usable? Like, could you see one of them as being made and it would have been a, you know, a classic Star Trek film, or did they really need Nicholas Meyer's input to make anything watchable?
Were they truly first drafts?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the People's script is so far afield from it's very metaphysical. It's very you know, it's very much about the mind, about mental powers. It's almost fantasy in a way. And so that one,
he wrote which original series script, John?
Where No Man Has Gone Before, which was
interesting. Yeah.
Right. So you know, I think that there's Of the drafts, if you look at them, you know, obviously the closest one is Soward's draft, who rightly deserves credit, you know, writing credit. And so, but the humanness, the human interaction, the humor, all the things that I think we take away from Wrath of Khan come because of Meyer putting them in there. So I think we would have had an okay movie if they did Soward's, but we had a great movie because of Myers.
Well, hearing you talk, and a lot of this I'm hearing for the first time, and I totally envy you getting to see. I mean, this is a case where being in Chicago rather than New York or L.A. is a bonus, because it was a hop, skip, and a jump for you to get to Iowa City, to the University of Iowa, and see his collection there. Because Nick said, when I got to know him and talk to him 4 or 5 years ago, I said, can I see it? You know, the script, all your library, your thing, is it still here? And it's like, no, I've already donated it to Iowa. And I'm like, oh, great, now I have to go to Iowa to see it. But so, you know, I'm jealous and envious there. But now I get it. I knew for years that Soward's name was, I'd said Soward, so if it's Soward's, it's great, is he's the guy that has screen credit, and Meyer for years and years did the lion's share of the rewriting, but in the way they were set up in his deal and everything, and, you know, DGA and WGA credits and blah, 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 that they weren't going to stick his name on it. So, but I knew that the script had changed vastly from his. But now I kind of get why his name is still attached to it, Jack Soward's, because if he created the Savick character, from what I think I heard you say, that's a real strong thing right there. I know it would be in TV. And even though if he created the bones, the skeleton that they hung everything else on, you know, people for far less have gotten, or people for far more have stayed on credits, and people for far less have been stripped off. So
yes,
the fact that he was the name they kind of stuck with. And it almost sounds like in that chronology, Harv did a draft, and then they went to, and then Sards did that, and then Peoples. And if Peoples was so far afield, it's like that's the pendulum, and they swung it back. You know, and it sounds like even though he made Savick a woman, and some of the other points you said, that legally and the way the credits are determined, that it was Soward's script that did it. And also, it almost sounds like, I don't know if the tone, or maybe you answer this, is the tone of any of those totally off from the humor and the flow? Because I know that Harv and Nick have both said when they first when Harv got it, and then Nick came in and said, "Oh, well, the first thing I think of is nautical, and I think hornblower." And Harv says, "Oh, that's what Gene always. That was his original motif for Kirk and the ship." And it was like an accidental, oh, they got it. And it's almost like it was born to work after that. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at, like, even when you look at, I think, 7% Solution, which is finally out on Blu-ray, I think, next week. I didn't get paid to say that. But, you know, it's a good film. And it's funny. There's that humor in there. And you see a lot of, I mean, you know, of course, a great thing is watch Star Trek VI and then watch the 7% Solution, because there's thematically some interesting connections. I mean, Spock really is Sherlock Holmes in Star Trek VI, and but there's humor in there, and I think, you know, Meyer is funny in a, not in a slapstick way, of course, but in an erudite way and in an intellectual way, and so I that humor and that really, that's what was missing from Star Trek the Motion Picture more than anything, was the humor and the interaction between those characters. There really wasn't anything wrong with that story. I mean, it's a good story, very Star Trek story, but it just, there wasn't that interplay, and I think Larry's absolutely right. Bennett and Meyer got the interplay, and maybe the first movie allowed the actors to sort of remember, well, what am I bringing back to this role, and what am I going to fight for these characters, to how should they live in this new movie? And so, you know, the first film, I think there's a lot to celebrate about it, but the second film got the characters, you know.
Well, I think a lot of, and I think the motion picture, that's why, if I think of it this way, actually JJ pulled off something better than maybe a lot of people want to give him credit for, because it's not just, oh, do a movie and put actors in it and do it, and oh, it's Star Trek and there's pressure on you. But it's the same way with Generations. Anytime you started one of these arcs of a movie, because Star Trek was a series, and no matter what the spinoff was, and anytime you transform it to a movie, you know, you go from having a family cast with a lead captain to, and maybe a number two, number one, number two, to no, we need a top bill, a second bill, and everybody else. And, you know, all the, like, the next gen movies became Picard, Data, everybody else. And that's just the way movies work, unfortunately, or that's the perception that movies work. And the thing that Motion Picture had to get over was being, A, the first one, and B, 10 years. And I think there was, you know, and they'd done Phase 2, and they spent all the money, and they rolled it up, and I get pissed when people talk about how much money, how the budget inflated on Motion Picture, because they took all the Phase 2 development and charged it off to the movie. So, you know, it's amazing that it made a profit, because that was 10 years of pent-up demand, but they point to how bloated the budget was and go, oh, you know, and it's Harv's story about Wrath of Khan. When Charlie, he does his impersonation of Charlie Bloodhorn, and I think I have that on tape, but he's done it many places before. It's probably out somewhere, maybe on the DVDs, where Charlie Bloodhorn's German and his head of Gulf and Western and said, "Did you see the motion picture?" And he says, "Yes, I did, Mr. Bloodhorn," and he says, "Do you think you can make a picture like that for less than $150 million? And he says, "Mr. Bloodhorn, I could make 5 pictures for $150 million or something." And it's a, you know, there's a lot more to that story, but it's really funny. And that's where they went down the track of the TV movie. But the point is, the politics and the corporate pressure, you know, and the whole reason they were doing it was because of Star Wars, and then, oh my God, Close Encounters, and it was a sci-fi boom, and oh, it's going to have tons of effects. And all of those kind of pressures that had nothing, they were totally, you know, Hollywood town, and had nothing to do with, you know, just the pressures of doing a Star Trek. And then you added that political pressure in. And it's amazing that Motion Picture tanks at all. It's almost like the second movie would be, you know, the hoops of just getting the damn thing done. And Generations was that way a little bit too, you know, with the baton passing thing. So, it's almost like it was a relief that the Motion Picture got a lot of that stuff out of the, there was still a lot of stuff that, well, where do we go from here now? You know, but a lot of the crap was out of the system by then. And, but I still think just the marriage of Harv and then Nick, finding Nick Meyer and bringing him in was just an amazing, they got so much mileage. I mean, I read Nick Meyer's book. You've read that, I'm sure, John, right?
Yes.
View from the Bridge.
Definitely.
And the thing that struck me, I didn't think about it, but they approached him to do, you know, he okay, Motion Picture's out of it. So he's involved as writer and or director on 2, 4, and 6. They ask him about directing 4, but I think they, Leonard had done 3 and wanted to do 4 again, but they asked him and went back to Leonard. But aside from that, and then Shatner directed 5, but they basically went to Nick Meyer on every movie after Motion Picture in some capacity, and if he's not involved in the credits, he turned them down for whatever reason. So it's,
yeah, I think he was offered 5, I believe.
Yeah.
To write 5. And,
right, and he didn't like the premise. Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Well, he thought it was an undoable movie, too. But like Harv told me later, that's one thing I show at the cons at my meetup now is him saying that 5 was basically he tried to tell himself after he turned Shatner down about being producer for it, because say we're going to go find God is not a premise you can do in a movie. The way he explains it, and that's probably the same thing that, you know, pushed Nick away. But it really got me how Nick Meyer could have been involved in every single post-TMP movie, either was or could have been in some degree. So the way that, I mean, we forget about that now, but he was really interwoven. 6, I think, there's things I regret about. It's a great story, but the visuals I don't like at times, but mashed potatoes. In the galley, and the phaser in the galley, and the dictionaries on the bridge, and all that. But yeah, I mean, and so the fact that this relationship started off with 3 or 4 bad passes in a movie, and they had, you know, on one hand, it's liberating to cast off everything from Motion Picture and start over, but then it's like, well, if Roddenberry and those guys couldn't do it, where can we? And the fact that Harv had this inner confidence, and, you know, Harv talks about sitting down and watching tapes, and he talked to fandom and found out Terry Meyer that used to do the Interstat letter comment zine, and he found, you know, BNFs, big name fans, that would tell him, oh, go watch these shows, and gave him 10 or 15 tapes to watch, and he goes through, you know, Sit on the Edge and Muck Time and Journey to Babel and Space Seed and blah blah blah, and it, and you know, he decided to go with Khan watching Space Seed, and then you know, going from there. But just that spark between those two men and what it did for Wrath of Khan first and the whole movie series after that is kind of like one of the great, you know, accidents or good fortunes, yeah, or whatever that Trek could. And I now the more I think about it, the more I'm thinking that we should not never you know, talk about catching lightning in a bottle and what that meant, you know, because if you didn't have a successful 2, 3, and 4, you wouldn't have had Next Generation and you know, and on.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel like they should have just given Nick Meyer the reins. Like, they've given it to JJ now. Just let him do 2, 3, and 4 his way and see where they go from there. And giving him 5 at least would have been a good idea.
He may not have brought back Spock. I mean, that's the... he may have had to have brought back Spock. But the main reason, at least my understanding, is that he did not do 3 was because he did not want to be the person to bring back Spock to write that story. He did 4 because Spock was back. It's a fact. There's nothing he could do about it. And now he says it's the, you know, looking at it over time, it was the right thing to do. But at that time, his feeling was you don't do that. And so
you don't cheat the earlier drama. You don't cheat the people that experienced 2 by bringing him back so cheaply.
Right. And, you know, and that, again, I think that, you know, to me, when I look at, when I look at both the movie itself and then all the making of documents and paperwork, you know, the main reason that I went into this from a sort of academic point of view, I guess, is this notion that Nicholas Meyer has that art thrives on limitations, which is a big thesis of his. And I think Star Trek's, from the very beginning, has been about the best example of something thriving, some popular culture, entertainment, some art thriving because of limitations. And Star Trek II, the story of Star Trek II to me in part is that story, right? You've got Kirk faced with limitations. He's got a limited crew on the ship with limited experience. He's got the limitation of age. He eventually has a ship that in and of itself is limited because of its the damage that it suffered, and the ability to transcend that limitation through, you know, creativity. Of course, it's also a story, which it appears the next film has an element of this too, about hubris, you know, about being prideful and thinking you know it all. And that's, you know, there's a lot of elements within the way you can read Star Trek II, but one of the ways that I read it is that it is, you know, not just art, but life itself, it thrives when we have limitations on them. And so, you know, I think in some ways all the limitations that were placed on this this troop of creators for Star Trek II, the budgetary limitations, the time limitations, the Roddenberry box, as Michael Piller calls it, you know, the rules that Roddenberry would want people to adhere to when they, you know, use Star Trek, all those things made Star Trek II better. And then other limitations like, you know, okay, we have to kill, we're going to kill Spock in this film, but then at the end, this, you know, realization that maybe we don't want to make this as permanent as we should, and then, you know, Leonard Nimoy coming up with the remember idea based on Harv Bennett asking him to think of some way to plant the seed of possibility. You know, all that's born out of limitations and boxes that we have to live in. And so, you know, to me, that's one of the exciting things about the story itself and the story of the making of the film is how all these people from the world of TV production, you know, many of them from TV production, mm-hmm. You know, show their very best because they're working on Star Trek, they're working on a movie. For many of them, it's their first feature film, and they really rose to the occasion.
Let's shift gears to another topic that I wanted to hear about, which, of course, center to this whole story is the villain himself, Khan. And
oh, that
we kind of take for granted, you know, I watched yesterday the Blu-ray version that has a commentary with Meyer and Manny Koto. And Meyer is talking about some of these scenes, like the reveal of Khan when he's first revealed on the Botany Bay, that was Montalban's very first day on the set. But yet it plays so polished. So we take for granted that, you know, Khan was always the villain and it was always Montalban. But I know you've uncovered a lot more information going all the way back to Space Seed about how we ended up with Khan as the villain.
Yeah, the very first, you know, if we're going to see Space Seed as the prequel, you know, to Wrath of Khan, obviously the originating story, the very first document ever is Cary Wilbur's proposal from the end of August 1966 that got submitted, I think, on September 1st. And basically the story was, it's a proposal, about 8 or 9 pages. He starts off the proposal, Cary Wilbur, who's one of the writers of Space Seed, musing about what a Renaissance man would be like in the 20th century. Starts talking about seed ships solving population troubles. So you talk about this Renaissance man in the 20th century. What would it be like if one of us from the 60s goes into the 23rd century? And that's sort of the idea of, you know, that Renaissance man in 1966 would be as out of place as a 1966 man 300 years from there. And so the story starts talking about how in the year 2096, a ship is sent from Earth called the Botany Bay on a 1500-year mission to reach SETI Alpha 2, or I think it's just called SETI 2. Mm-hmm. And now what's interesting is they say after 500 years, the machinery starts failing and the Enterprise comes across it. And one of the things that they talk about in the memos, Gene Kuhn's memos, is, look, we've never specified when the series takes place.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking here, the series is barely on the air. I think maybe 2 episodes, 3 episodes.
What's the date on it?
Well, the dates, this version, the proposal, is September 1st, so it's actually before...
It's been all because Gene right? Kuhn came in about halfway through the first season after John D.F. Yeah. Black, so
yeah,
so they're on like a half season, but yeah, they hadn't nailed it. They were staying intentionally vague, like, oh, we'll keep Guinan's background vague, we'll keep the timeline of, but they had this show made them start trying to tie that down,
right? Exactly. So they hadn't specified that, and that was one of the notes to Wilbur for his next draft. But there's a character, Marla MacGyvers, who's the second communications officer. And they find the ship. The ship has like an automatic defense system, and it tries to attack the Enterprise, but of course the Enterprise is able to defeat it easily. Kirk and the landing party go on board the ship, and they're attacked by robotic defenses, which they defeat. Eventually what happens is they defrost a guy by the name of Harold Erickson, who is described as a Viking. He's an Aryan, perfect blonde, huge, you know, man. But nowhere in this proposal And frankly, nowhere in the drafts until later, much later, is it specified that he's genetically enhanced. It's just that he's somehow stronger. They don't specify how or why or whatever. But anyway, Rand is in the script, and she eventually, of course, won't be on the show by the time they produce this and it airs. But she teases Marla about being preoccupied with Harold Erickson. Anyway, to kind of condense the story, there's a man named Henderson on the ship. He's an older man, and he kind of comes to also. And Erickson kills him. And the reason is, what it turns out is, what they think is an immigrant ship sent from Earth to colonize because of the population trouble is actually a ship of criminals, common criminals.
Botany Bay.
To solve the problem of overpopulation, we ship people off into space as criminals. Now, in the final version of the script, Kirk actually suggests that, and Spock kind of mocks him for, that's a stupid idea. Why would people wouldn't waste their resources, you know, doing that? So it was almost like a little jab at the original premise that we would have spent all this money sending prisoners into space. And so one of the neat things in the script, though, is Erickson takes over the ship, and he keyhauls Kirk. So he puts Kirk in a spacesuit and kicks him off the ship to die. And what Marla does is Marla has a change of conscience. And when they're getting ready to keyhaul Kirk, she starts screaming at him for how bad he's treated her, and she slips him a propulsion device. So Kirk is out in space. Khan thinks he's dead, but Kirk isn't. He shuts off the monitor, and Kirk uses his propulsion device to go to the ship. So you can imagine the expense that this
Bob Justman's having a heart attack reading these notes.
Right, So that's sort of the original script of this. That it ends with Erickson and Marla being put down on a planet with their people, just like in the version that we're familiar with. But what happens is there's like a series of memos that start and a series of rewrites. Some of the more interesting ones are Bob Justman, as Larry mentioned, on September 6th, 1966, calls this a great story but incredibly expensive. And really makes a pitch for the idea that we need more people stories, that this is more of a Buck Rogers story. It should be saved, but they need people stories. They want more, and he want more Charlie X stories. And interestingly, there's a memo from NBC that says we want less Charlie X stories because Charlie X bored the audience with his internal wonderings. I mean, that's sort of what the memo says. But the most important of these memos back and forth, there's two of them. One is from September 9th, 1966, and this is from Gene Kuhn to Cary Wilbur. And in there, he defines the character of Erickson in a way that eventually we're familiar with. What Kuhn does, he does a whole big long memo about how we need to turn this guy into somebody who is James Kirk. He has to be the equal of James Kirk. He needs to be as intelligent and, in fact, more intelligent, smarter. It's as if this had been Kirk and this had happened to Kirk, and that he shouldn't be a villain, but that he should be a great man who's in this circumstances. He calls him a creative destroyer in the memo.
This is sounding awfully familiar to some things we're hearing about the new movie, actually.
Yeah, I mean, and so and that he's supposed to be wise, and that Spock would follow him, and McCoy would follow him, at least they'd be tempted to, that he needs to be a really great man. And then Gene Roddenberry actually suggests that they share physical or some personality trait, like the way they give orders. So there was really this idea that they were kind of setting Khan up to be kind of like, where in the original version he's more just sort of a criminal, setting him up to be more of a, I guess you could say, you know, Lex Luthor, the equal, the person who could really challenge Kirk. But what's interesting is in the December 6th memo by Roddenberry, he's still being called Erickson. What happens then is Ricardo Montalban, the casting agent, the person who's responsible for casting on the show, for whatever reason, and nobody who I spoke to can remember why they would even think of Ricardo Montalban, except that there was a lot of discussion of this guy needs to be able to romance Marla. They had a lot of problems with that Marla character. how to make her believable, how to bring her into the story in a way that she didn't seem pathetic, and how she changed her allegiance so quickly. And maybe that's it. Maybe he thought of somebody who's physically impressive but also suave and debonair. But for whatever reason, the casting director came up with the idea of Montalban, went to Gene Roddenberry. Roddenberry said, yes, I love that idea. And because of Montalban's casting, they retooled the character. In fact, some of the versions of the scripts even have, the very late versions of the script have changed the name Erickson to Khan.
Are you talking about
Page.
John? Yes. When you're talking about casting, are you talking about Joe DiAgusta? When you're talking about casting?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Yes. And so, and then his original name on the December 12th script was Sebel Khan Noonien, and DeForest Research, not anything to do with DeForest Kelley, but DeForest Research that did all the research for the scripts and the shows, they did a whole dissertation on how if he is actually a Sikh, he would have the name Singh as his last name, and you need to change the name. And they suggest the name of Govind Badr Singh. Eventually what happens is Roddenberry, who wants to reach a friend of his,
right,
whose name is similar to Noonien Singh and Noonien Sung, changes it and it becomes Khan Noonien Singh.
That's good, because I really would hate to see Kirk scream, Govind!
Seabow would be amazing. Yeah. Right?
Seabow!
Hey, John. This is really funny because, you know, for years Lincoln, Roddenberry.com, but Lincoln for 20, 30 years, Roddenberry's company, you know, their scripts they sold, and if you ordered the Space Seed script, you didn't get a final draft. You got, I mean, this made me go back and look at this. You got a draft from, now in your chronology, now that we're like micro-focusing on dates and times, the show was shot, now that you've got me inspired here, the show was shot December 15th to 23rd. Okay. So right. This draft I've had for ages, it was not a Khan script, but it has the Erickson name in it, and he tells him his name is John Erickson by this time. Dum, dum, dum! Erickson Harrison. This is dated December 8th. So it's, you know, if you're talking about a script that had it changed to Khan on the 12th, you said?
Right. The final script, which is on the 12th, has the, not Khan Noonien Singh name, but the Sebel
I want to see what
Khan
this...
name, yeah.
Yeah, so they started shooting on the 15th. I want to see what like days of the week. If like 15th was a Monday and they, you know, the 12th was Friday, but on the 8th before the 12th, it was still
it was
Erickson and the way it was evolving and SETI 2 and some of those things were the way, you know, the way they were. But there's some of the lines that are starting to evolve the same way. But anyway,
yeah, I think what's really important about that is that, you know, the character, the background of the character, the removal of the Viking notion and more the you know, what we think of as Khan and the reference to being a Sikh and all of that, the guess anyway. She
and the third world,
sure,
that comes
the
to
third
the
world, all that's added because of the casting of Ricardo Montalban. And I
was
think
the whole
that
thing
just,
of eugenics and genetic engineering, did that not come through in the script until the Khan change, or was genetics
that
and,
comes
and
right
eugenics?
That is not right, exactly. There is some mention of genetics as a possibility in some of the memos, but that doesn't get really put into the script until the version that's close to what we're all familiar with.
Was like a late ad, is what you're saying. Like,
yeah, so that,
the
so
late. That's
which
fascinating.
In some ways, I mean, really, to me, that's very important because Montalban shaped this role not only through his performance, but just by them casting him. I mean, from the very start, he owned this role, you know. And it was, in essence, you know, it's certainly not unheard of for backgrounds of characters to be tweaked to match an actor if they choose one actor or another actor or change the sex, perhaps, of a character in a script because an actress is better than an actor for the role or something like that. But for Star Trek purposes,
it's
pretty
costume.
Significant that Roddenberry was, Montalban really was the impetus for kind of creating the backstory of Khan as we know it, and really just shows you how talented Gene was to be able to turn all these scripts around so quick.
Well, that
make
was
these changes so quick.
That was Gene Kuhn being miracle guy again. Aside from he gets, you know, the Klingon credit, the Prime Directive credit, and all that, but just, and something gets overlooked, and I knew it in my head, but to sit here and analyze it again, if you go back and link back to Gene Kuhn for Khan, and it's not just Khan and the Wrath of Khan legacy and all that, but think of what Star Trek has done, and people, you know, fanboys love to argue over this to this day, the whole thing about genetic engineering and what they, how it's treated in Star Trek. And it's almost like it's one, you know, oh, every race, every creed, every color, is we're all equal, but damn those, any, you know, heaven forbid you go and tinker genetically, because we had the eugenics wars and all the, you know, all the spin-off plots and all the stuff that was used in DS9, and well, that attitude that carries through because it's part of the background in any, its original series, Grounded, and it's in Wrath of Khan. So anybody, any writer, much less any fanboy turn writer, you know, whether it's Ron Moore or Ira or Manny or Brandon or whoever it is, that all comes through. You know, that's an attitude in Next Generation, but it doesn't really slap you in the face over and over again like it became in Voyager a little bit. But DS9 and Enterprise are where it really, you know, later DS9. And you think about how all those plots emerged, and it all goes back to apparently this very late... I love doing research by podcast. It's amazing. It's like it's like this this major branch of this thread, this root of this theme of Star Trek started, you know, and all it was Gene Kuhn under the gun trying to make a story better, and oh, we've just cast, and if I'm hearing you right, that's what it basically was. That was a change that got added to the script as a texture of having cast. Ricardo Montalban. Right?
Yeah, I mean copies of these would be Roddenberry scripts. Copies of Roddenberry scripts have the name Erickson crossed out and written in handwriting, in Roddenberry's handwriting, Khan.
Yeah.
Because it was so late in the process that all of that occurred.
But I mean, but it's something that Gene Kuhn did to add to the character and give probably some justification for the dramatic situation. And the whole backstory, you know, that's what happens in Star Trek so much, and now that there's kind of a renaissance of gap-filling and backgrounding in David Goodman's book, and maybe something I'm working on but not supposed to talk about, it's you're going back to those like accidents of history. It's just fun, you know, hindsight's wonderful. And, you know, we see things now and you trace it back to root, and it was just because somebody said, oh, we're all out of green. Let's put the security guys in red. I mean, you know, I'm being silly and I just invented that. But I mean, those kinds of decisions, you know, in 40 years, and you make fun of it. And, you know, you watch a parody on Futurama and people are, oh, yes, they're all in the red, you know, oh, yes, the red shirt. And it's because somebody sneezed that day the wrong way in the wrong language and a decision was made. And 80 years later, people are worshiping this thing because 90 different stories in four generations evolved out of that fact. I mean, it just, I'm starting to blather now, but it's, you know what I'm saying.
Well, it's great that it's Montalban because he brings such a presence to the role. I couldn't think of another original series villain that I really would have wanted to see show up in one of the films, except maybe the Klingons. But like, yeah, Gary Mitchell, I really wouldn't have cared if they'd done a Gary Mitchell film. But to bring Montalban back, and you talk about the way he owned that role the moment he stepped on the film stage, that was such a big part of it. And if they just cast someone who looked like William Shatner to play somebody called Erickson, I think we might have forgotten about the episode a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. And then the fact that after we all have sat here and praised him again, and that he was in such great shape with, you know, the whole, yes, it was his real chest, on Wrath of Khan, the fact that everybody says now, I've heard Nick Meyer say this, at least, that Montalban was so paranoid about coming back and playing Khan, you know, and like, oh, I hope I can recapture this. And it's like, well, go back and watch the show. And it took him like a day, and he was like, oh, yeah, I can, you know. But when they first said, come in and do it, he was like, I don't know if I can. You know, it was, you know, being a good, humble actor. And they were like, well, of course you can. And of course he did. But it's interesting that he, you know, needed some reassurance and some research at the beginning.
Hmm.
On Wrath of Khan.
One of my favorite stories is that on his first day, you know, he had that long monologue to do, and where he is sort of telling his backstory, and it's all exposition,
yeah,
you know.
All in the Botany Bay shelter.
Yeah, and he, you know, he has these marks that he has to hit on the floor, and it's a complex scene, and how do you do it? And he never made a mistake, but because, you know, he was always professional and well-prepared, but he was very... I think Meyer says it was to the rooftops. You know, the performance at the start was to the rooftops, and he was, you know, here's, you know, Meyer's a, you know, a person in his early 30s. He had only directed one other film before then. And here he is. He's going to be directing a man who had been acting, 15 years before he was even born, and had been in so many amazing films, and was a great dancer, and and singer. "Baby, It's Cold Outside" was sung and won the Academy Award because of Esther Williams and Ricardo Montalban singing in "Neptune's Daughter." And so, he was a super talented man with this long career, and here's this young director, and Meyer was a little trepidatious. How will he accept direction? How will he feel about that? And he took Montalban aside and said, the thing about crazy people is, they don't act like that. That's what makes them scary. And Montalban got it, and he said something to the effect of, you're good, you're going to direct me. And he wanted that. He wanted that collaboration. He was a humble man, who wanted to be directed and who wanted to contribute his very best. And, he is in many ways, I think, 50% of why that film is successful, is him, is his performance, not to take anything away from anyone else. But, if that villain didn't work, that film would have been, miserable. It's like the truth of any film, right? If the villain isn't strong, your hero doesn't have a great challenge. Yeah. And Kirk has a great challenge with him, and it's just two great actors. Speaking of limitations, one of my favorite things that's come out of the research is, in one of the early versions of the script, including a version that went very close to production, there was a physical meeting between Khan and Kirk, and it occurs in the Genesis cave. And so the moment, the whole yelling Khan moment, the whole payoff of that would not have occurred had this scene been in there. It was in the script. There's no reason for Kirk to yell Khan. The two of them fight with sabers, Kirk loses. And Khan takes the Genesis torpedo and says, "I'm going to leave you here," and goes off. And one of the things it does do is sort of reinforces the loss of Marla a little more than the movie otherwise does. But in many ways, that scene is completely unnecessary. So you have to stage that fight scene. It would have been very expensive to do, very time-consuming to do, and really ultimately unnecessary. And so that was ejected out of the script, and instead you get this verbal back and forth. And so you need a payoff, right? You need a climax to that scene because you don't know the physical fight. So the climax becomes the yelling of Khan. So for whatever it cost to film that one moment of film, you got a much better sequence than had they had a fight scene that would have just looked like a poor man's lightsaber battle.
Until you find the big wrench laying on the table over at the side of the room.
Right, exactly. And in fact, that scene that scene winds up in the third film almost verbatim. Some of the words are changed and that sort of thing, but the fight between Krug and Kirk is really that fight. And in many ways, if you think about it, it's the same thing. Kirk taunting the guy and him coming down and that sort of thing. So, it's, I think, a great example of ingenuity, of knowing how to use these actors well, knowing the limitations of the budget and the time that they had, and really knowing how to edit a story and put a story together. And so that scene would have been maybe interesting, it would have been exciting, but it was unnecessary, and I'd much rather have the Khan yell than that scene.
You were talking before the show, actually on the other side of the room, about how it was going to be a TV movie, and then they got more money. Could you go more into that?
Sure.
There was
uncertainty about how to proceed with Star Trek II. One idea was to do a movie of the week. Another idea, which was really where some of the energy was put, was to produce it on a movie of the week budget, and if it was good enough, release it in theaters. Which, again, was done with Buck Rogers. It was done with Battlestar Galactica, and so on. There had been precedent for that kind of thing.
Well, after the fact.
Right, or after the fact. Yeah. Although Buck Rogers was done, I think, before and then turned into a show. But, they knew they were going to TV for those shows. And then in Battlestar Galactica, they re-edited episodes and released it after the show would have done. So there had been some precedent for that. And I think what happened is eventually Paramount saw what was occurring, saw the story as it was shaping up, and really was satisfied with that Meyer script. And what happens is in late September 1981, after Meyer has completed his final draft, there's a memo where they do a comparison and contrast. What if we don't do it as a movie of the week? What if we do it as a film? And unfortunately, they don't have all the details yet on Meyer's script, so they base it on some of the earlier versions or whatever. But it's interesting because you see the difference in the cost. So, for example, when it was a movie of the week, Kirk's quarters, his apartment, was going to cost $4,000 to put together. But when it became a film, it would cost $20,000.
Right.
And
right.
You see those kinds of changes and everything, you know, how much the editor is paid and so on. Everything goes up because it moves to a film, and it eventually gets budgeted at about $10 million. If we're going to do it as a movie, we're going to do it at about $10 million. Now, if you think about that, Empire Strikes Back, which had come out, you know, a year and a half before, was $25 million. So they were dealing with less than half the budget of Empire Strikes Back. And so they decided to go the film route, and they wound up with a film budget. But ironically, many of the crew were movie of the week people, and who had, you know, many exceptionally talented people. I mean, the cinematographer, the director of photography, Gayn Reschner, had won awards, and he was a marvelous cinematographer and knew how to move that camera, how to light, and all those things. But this was really his first motion picture. But that really was a good thing because it allowed people to sort of work on a bigger canvas than they might be otherwise used to working on and really bring their creative energies to everything. Eventually what happened is Paramount had so much confidence in the production that they gave them more money, and they wound up with, like, I think it finally cost about $11.2 million to make it, which still, you know, was a very low budget. But it was really born out of the movie of the week idea. It's an interesting memo because you just sort of see the prices of everything.
Yeah, and just in case, exponentially higher. Yeah, I was gonna say, and people get an idea of budgets that way, but as far as the people and the personalities and attitudes of Hollywood, it's lessened up a little bit now because we've got so much media floating around. But especially back, you know, in the up and through all through the first 30, 40 years of TV, there was very much a dividing line between TV and film. And unless you made a break, you got a break somewhere along the way early in your career of whatever you were doing, whatever your guild, whether you're an actor or director or writer or whatever, some were easier than others. But that dividing line between TV land and film land was such. So for these guys to be TV, you know, the cream of the creme de la creme of the TV world doing TV movies, you know, there's a snob sneer factor going on there where a lot of the people that would do when TV movies and miniseries had such big budgets and kind of came the cream of the crop on TV, but there were still the movie people that, if they wanted to, the dark side would look down and sneer and go, oh, yeah, but it's still TV, and that kind of snob factor. So for these guys to, I mean, a lot of TV people Rick Berman brought along to work on Generations, and it was a big break, a motion picture break for a lot of the crew and the designers on Generations that they did that with. They backtracked a little after First Contact, but it's that same thing of giving those guys a break and a leg up, and the fact that so many of them, you know, and probably most people in that boat, that's an artificial sneer snobbery thing going on, but it's just the class system of Hollywood, and it's a little looser now than it was. But just putting it back in context, what you're saying, John, is that was a big thing for those people to get the chance to do it and then to deliver so well. And I don't know about individuals. I hope a lot of them, you know, if they got to break through the glass ceiling of, and that's, we reserve that for women. If they got to break through the glass wall and go over and do, you know, motion pictures after that, you know, some of those individuals, you know, good on them. But it's the kind of thing that's a big deal for them to get the opportunity, much less to pay off on it.
Yeah, I was thinking about how they, when you think of the film, how I think what it would, the estimate is 65% or something of the film takes place on one set, which is the bridge, because the bridge of the Enterprise is also the bridge of the Reliant. And it's because of the lighting and camera movement and special effects mm-hmm. crews and all those artists that we can cut back and forth, not get confused, and really sort of believe they're two different ships. Just by change, you know, by doing things like changing the upholstery, changing the lighting scheme, putting in some different panels.
Yeah, they are pulling them out for the Reliant.
Yeah. And so it, you know, really speaks to that ingenuity of these of the people that worked on the film.
And some of the biggest things they did. Now, you know, one of the losses that we don't get to talk about a lot is we were talking about Gene Coonan earlier, who died in 73 of lung cancer. And you know, didn't survive to see the big Trek. He didn't get to see the big Rebirth, the movie rumor mill, much less the movie, much less everything that came after motion picture. And plus being able to interview him. Oh my God, I would love to go back to 1970 or 71 and sit down and talk to Gene Coon. But another one like that is Mike Miner, who died of AIDS in the 80s later, but was a big part of who had been like a young artist in third season of the original series and got to know Bob Justman and Gene and some of those people and did, you know, some of the artwork on the walls is his when you start seeing little dinky paintings blossom on the mm-hmm. bare walls on third season. And he Harold Michelson, the whole thing of the landscape, talking about what a budget they had and like reusing the bridge so much and the few times they did try to have some scope, what they did on that budget scale – the Seti Alpha landscape, you know, the sandstorm, and mm-hmm. coming through and going into the shelters. And when you do, and you said you got access to pictures. I mean, there's a lot of obscure and rare ones I've seen too, but I'm jealous of you having 400 there. But I'm hoping some more of those. I've seen the ones of that set. You know, it's an onstage set. And when they get the wind machines going and the sand, and that's a, you know, a real pain in the ass to shoot through because the sand's penetrating everything. It's like being in a real sandstorm. But the effect they were able to do and have the yellow cast to it and all that, you know, with lighting and camera filters. But they really sold that. And it's just a simple, you know, stage set with the shelters as a backdrop. But some of the tricks were Spock and Kirk are in the hall coming out of the simulator. And the he did a television trick to do over the top of the frame to get more depth in that little dinky set. And you know, some of the things they pulled off to do. But, John, wouldn't you say that the one place where the movie, where the TV, like, scope, scale, budget did trick them up a little bit was, I mean, what would you say was the one, like, the drawback of money in that movie? I have my one candidate. I wanted to see what you thought. Where being on a smaller, but we're having a little more money either up front to plan better or whatever wasn't the best. I mean, they could have used a little more money and had a little bit better, you know, image or effect.
Myers says you know, there's he doesn't have the sort of mindset of going back and redoing the effects of the films. But I think one of the things that he said that he wishes was better, although I still think it looks good, but is the Genesis cave.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, that kind of looks like a set and. You know, and it was certainly, when you see the pictures of what it was, I mean, it was, you know...
It was like a bowl.
Yeah, it was, you know, a crazy-looking thing. It's and like then, of course, it was stuck into a matte painting, and, you know...
Well, I mean, and not so much the physical set, but the effect, like, they tried to have the little waterfall inside, and it's obviously, yeah. When you get it on the big screen, it kind of falls apart a little bit. It's just a little disappointing, but it's only a few seconds, and you move on. But I know in light of what we see, even the later Trek movies pre-JJ, that would have been gotten a lot better treatment, yeah. You know, with technology and a little bit more money. But yeah, well, it's amazing what they did do. But that's Star Trek heritage, whether it's a movie or a TV show, yeah. Is what they do with them.
But it does such a good job of hiding its budget deficit. I mean, it's only when you really break it down, like watching it now in, you know, 2013 and imagine what the budget looks like. You know, they had spent this much money on this set, and you realize they only had one bridge set. You start realizing it's a low-budget film. But I think when people went to go see it when it first came out, I don't think people felt like, oh, well, this obviously only cost a third of what Empire cost.
Oh, no. I mean that yeah. Mutara battle. You know, part of it is because, and I think that speaks to, again, the script. And Meyer's contributions there that and then also people like Joseph Jennings who him and Miner were the ones I believe who thought of
yeah and thank you I said Harold Michelson, right? That was motion picture Joe Jennings, yes.
But you know, I the that is a, such a wonderful a space battle, and you know, just two submarines, right? And they're following each other under the water, and so it's. I certainly didn't feel. I only felt it was everything I wanted to see when I saw it. I mean, it was. It had everything that you wanted in it. It was. It wasn't Star Wars, which would have been so easy for them to go that route and to pull a Star Wars. And I mean, and if you think about it, there's the reveal of the father-son relationship. I mean, there's notes there that you could have walked away from that film, especially if they had had a saber fight. I mean, you could have walked away from that film and gone, boy, that was a retread of Empire Strikes Back or something, or Star Wars. And it's nothing like it, and it's a completely different animal, and as it should be, because Star Trek is different than Star Wars. And so, you know, I think that there's very, I mean, the score, the music, there's nothing in that film to me that speaks of where I felt cheapness. The same thing with Star Trek VI, where I look at it and I go, you know, I mean, in both films, there's like a wow moment of special effects that carry you the whole film in a way. I think in VI, it's that assassination scene. When you first saw it, it was almost like hard to wrap your brain around it, because you see these floating globs of blood. I mean, it was just amazing. It was the way it was edited, the music and the zero G effects, just brilliant. And then, you know, of course you get the disorienting on the large screen, Genesis effect, you know, in Star Trek II, one of the first uses of, I think it's listed as the first, but that's not necessarily true, but it's one of the first uses of CGI in films. You know, in a brilliant use of it, so good they used it in the next, you know, it's wonderful. And so, you know, it's like for, you know, Star Trek, the people who create Star Trek, I think are great at coming up with solutions to that. So you look at First Contact, they put all the sort of special effects stuff at the start in a compact way, but it makes the film seem huge when really it isn't. Certainly a bigger budget than Wrath of Khan, but nowhere near what Hollywood blockbusters were getting at the time they made First Contact. Mm-hmm. So you put all the special effects up front, and then you tell the story after that. In a way, it's kind of what Empire does. Empire Strikes Back does as well, though, but they have huge effect sequences throughout that film. And so, you know, the Star Trek people, I think, especially, really deserve a lot of credit for working without. And even in the new films, it seems, I mean, their budgets are much, much larger, but they do a lot of old school film techniques. I mean, in the last film, when Kirk is hanging over the side of the you know, Nero's weapon, my power drill, he, they do it with a mirror behind him. Mm-hmm. So it reflects the sky. And it looks like he's dangling over the side of, you know, a huge precipice. So they're really good, I think, in some ways. Maybe because Star Trek is about science, it kind of engenders a certain kind of creativity that maybe some other films might not.
Well, you were talking earlier about the limitations, and I think I never thought about that until early in Next Generation, and I first got to talk and meet with Mike and Okuda, and when he was talking about the fact that the original series was not a favorite child, and they were always on to them about budgets and all that. And here, Lost in Space, CBS was touting it, and it was going to be the big glitzy show, and it had a year up on Star Trek, and it was in black and white the first year, you know, before it went to color. And saying, well, you know, but in hindsight, having a smaller budget, if Matt Jeffries and Jimmy Rugg on effects, if they'd had the budget that Lost in Space had, the Enterprise Bridge would have looked like the Jupiter II's control room, as in the 60s version of rows and rows of blinky lights. But because all they could do was, you know, have marbles and Christmas lights on plywood, it becomes an ally, and if you're smart about it, then you have this thing that it looks so simple that it's all the implied power and all the, you know, Mike McMaster and the first blueprinters and all that. And over the years, we came up with the idea of, well, it's not like a label button, label button, label button. These there's multiple functions, and you hit over here and you're label, you know, so you don't have labels on the panel, and this whole mystique about how that operates. And then, of course, now that's what we do. We do have multiple, but you know, we have touch screens now, and then Mike coming up with the touch screen interface on Next Generation, where it was just a cheap way to lay down plastic with a, you know, behind it, and you didn't have to have individual hardware mounted buttons and things and go crazy gluing not only on your standing sets, but every week you had to do new sets. And it's like, oh, it's so powerful because you've got, and now, like, you know, God, we've got it on, you know, it's iPad, it's touchscreen, everything. So it's you know, and then you hear John Dwyer on the original series set dressing talking about dumpster diving. And that's the grand old, you know, the grand old Star Trek thing, which they would do on the movies, and they would do it on Next Gen and all the shows. I mean, you know, it's like, what can we grab this off of, or Herman talking about it? Go to the lumber yard or someplace and get all the industrial crap, and bang, now it's that grid you see on every transporter and half of the alien planets, and sometimes you laugh about it like makeup foreheads being aliens. But those guys are amazing. And as far as Wrath of Khan goes, you know, Next Gen and its movies and Voyager and DS9, they had that, those warehouses of crap that they've been auctioning off the last 4 or 5 years, that stuff built up to where they had half a movie, two-thirds of a movie, even not even counting the standing sets, was sitting there to be repurposed. But Wrath of Khan, they had the bridge, and they had some of the sets, and like they redid the, you know, the Klingon bridge from Motion Picture to be, I've just gone blank in Wrath of Khan. But, I mean, they didn't have a huge backlog of warehouse pieces to do, but that Star Trek thing of, because they had to. And that's the limitations you were talking about. Sometimes the limitations, if you're not handed a blank check, make you be more creative, and you actually wind up with more texture and depth than you even realize you're doing. Which is why it was insane to me on JJ's movie when they talk about, well, we had to go to the brewery for engineering because we decided to put the money in. We didn't have the budget. You're like, oh, really? You know, anybody that worked on even the Next Gen movies would die for this budget. Well, but on their size and their level and scope,
yeah,
you know, they were putting the money into effects and not doing it, so they went to the Budweiser plant. So, but yeah, limitations.
Where Keenzer works, he makes beer.
Where Keenzer works, yeah, the Canadian, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess one last thing to bring this into the present day, John, as we pass an hour here, you recently wrote a piece to make your case that John Harrison is Khan, and I've been thinking for a long time now that he's Gary Mitchell, but tell us, in the other side of the room, we talked about it a little bit, and I think you pretty much convinced me, so tell us, we touched on a bit of it along the way, why is John Harrison Khan? Why are we going to see Khan again?
Well, you know, it's a guess, and no better guess than anybody else's guess, and although I think, you know, I feel confident in my guess, but that doesn't mean I'm right, of course. So I always leave a big door for, you know, the fact that I certainly could be wrong. But I there's a bunch of reasons. One is when you just think of the mentality of Hollywood itself. So I'm a producer at Paramount, and I'm giving you $150 million to make a movie. Do I want to see Gary Mitchell, who has to be explained to the majority of the world, or do I want to see Khan, who is, you know, I would imagine, other than the Borg, probably the most recognizable villain in Star Trek history easily. So just from a production point of view, I don't know that I'm going to sink $150 million into a Gary Mitchell movie or Garth of Izar or any other good guesses.
Yeah, and that's definitely what we were saying back at the beginning when we didn't know casting rumors were still up in the air. We were saying Khan just makes sense. I think I said that like a couple months after the first film came out. But now they're saying Harrison is the name of it. And
yeah, I mean, and that's the other thing. Do you name your... If Harrison is Harrison, that's the name of your villain. Because that's such a memorable, why not just call him John Smith? I mean, it's about as weak a name as possible. And but I also think of the production history of this film. I think of some of the producers talking about how the initial idea was to end the last film with an Easter egg at the end, and it would have just been the Botany Bay floating in space, and then after the credits, and then it would, you know, be a little fun little thing. I think about all the people that they tried to cast, all the way up until about 3 weeks before filming. And it was Benicio del Toro, and they wanted Javier Bardem, all these people that they wanted who were, Hispanic actors or Latino actors, which of course could have been John Harrison, but John Harrison, that seems like a strange.
Well, it's Juan Harrison.
Right. I mean, it just seems like a strange choice. I also think that there's just too much stuff in the trailers that we've seen that makes me believe it's Khan. I don't think you put the iconic hand gesture. I'm presuming, of course, but it looks to me like that's Spock, and that probably is Kirk. Kirk does have his black shirt on during the film. That doesn't mean Kirk. Maybe it's Kirk who dies. Maybe it's Spock who dies. Maybe it is John Harrison and Spock is doing the gesture. But you don't do that gesture with glass unless you don't do it as an offshoot reference to The Wrath of Khan. And you have Carol Marcus in the movie? I don't think so. And then, of course, in the trailer, you see frozen glass, right? Tubes with people. I mean, those aren't coffins. People, unless they get really weird in the future, people don't put, glass windows on coffins. So those are, and you can see there's frost on them. There are people inside of them. And then he's called, he has superhuman powers. And when
they found
at,
the 37s, John.
Yeah, could be. When you look at his superpowers, I mean, some of the people who disagree with me, and there's good reason to disagree, say that, well, Khan doesn't have those kind of abilities. Well, Khan had those abilities. They were spoken of. McCoy says directly he could lift the two of us with one arm. Hmm. It's just they didn't have the budget to show that. They would have had him jumping around and doing all that stuff, that superhuman stuff. And then this notion that somehow he has the ability to cure people, which people are presuming maybe because he has a knowledge of genetics or something, there is a reference in Space Seed that there's something about Khan internally that won't let him die. He's laying on the bed, and McCoy says to the effect that, there's something in this man that he won't die. And so, there's just too many parallels. And maybe I'm reading stuff into it, but when you look at the collars in this film, the collars look like Wrath of Khan collars. Harrison's collar looks like a souped-up version of Khan's collar in 2. And of course there's no mention of who is Peter Weller playing. My guess is he's a villain because Peter Weller, has he ever played a good guy?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so he's a villain of some kind. So, that gives them the out of saying the villain isn't Khan, because maybe the villain isn't Khan. Right. But it's, we think of him as, a RoboCop, but we think of him as a villain, I think.
Right.
Kind of has that reputation, and
then
maybe
they're
going to go against the way he's generally characters he acts. So, but I think all those reasons just sort of lead me to believe that, they're going. And then, of course, the scripts, John Harrison sounds an awful lot like, Erickson Harrison, just sounds an awful lot. Harold Erickson Harrison, they sound an awful similar to one another. And, none of this could be why it's Khan, but I think that those sort of point me to feel that it's Khan. And the reason I don't think it's Gary Mitchell is because the comic books featured Gary Mitchell. They resolved his story. And unlike the comics from the days of Marvel and DC, these are not made unless Bad Robot says okay. And I don't think they would introduce Gary Mitchell in the comic and then retell that story.
Right.
Not on this short a time frame and memory span and, yeah. And,
yeah, so mm-hmm. so I, you know,
direct hands-on.
I mean, I guess the two biggest possibilities are Peter Weller is Khan, and which is possible, and John Harrison is John Harrison, like he's Yalcom basically without being Yalcom maybe, and then and so he's the one who does the action, and Khan is kind of sits back and does things, manipulates things. That's possible. But I believe they've said, if I'm not mistaken, Peter Weller is not. I think he's in Starfleet. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I thought he was in Starfleet. Yes,
or an admiral or something like that. I don't know.
The odd thing is the song and dance that they're going through to really pound in that Harrison's a former member of Starfleet and he's Kirk's Achilles heel and he's a terrorist with ideals. They're really, really, really trying to make us think he's not Khan, which is just a little confusing. Like, why not just be mysterious about it? Why be so clear on him being a different kind of character?
Yeah, I mean, there's all these other little things you can look at. Zachary Quinto accidentally spills the name Khan in an interview online and then retracts that back. It's a Freudian slip, maybe, or a mistake, just a mistake, but that seemed revealing to me. I know there's some difference in English, British English and American English, but the phrasing that Benedict Cumberbatch used where he said, I play this person, not someone who's called that, called, maybe that's called is what they say, named, I don't know, but called and named are two different things. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be kind of a strange. Why not just say, I am not Khan? Khan is not in this film. If you want to end, it's a very simple statement to make. Khan isn't in this film. John Harrison is the bad guy. He's a terrorist. And we're making a commentary about that sort of thing. Why?
You might do that if all you're trying to do is just gin up the PR promo online gossip viral drip machine. And it has nothing to do with Khan, but you're not about to let that go. Just like they did that with the first movie, the false rumors and everything, just to keep people talking. So
right, and it's working. I mean, certainly we're all wondering who's going on, and they're brilliantly hiding. You know, I would imagine it looks like a lot of the film from us. You know, in terms of what they're showing us, they haven't shown us a single. Yeah. I don't believe there's a single picture of Weller out there.
Either they are hiding a lot of it, or they're not, or we've seen everything, and we're getting ourselves in a frenzy over.
Oh, fans
nothing,
would
really.
Never do that. What are you talking about, Craig? Star Trek fans would never get themselves into a frenzy about the unknowns of an upcoming film. All right. Well, we've gone really long on this show, so we should close this one out. It's fascinating. I mean, we could keep talking for hours and hours on this, but
John, that was amazing. I just want to say real quick that I totally envious of you of the amount of research you've been able to do getting into Nick's files there in Iowa, and that's great. Are you working on something bigger, or can you say, or are you just doing?
I'm very fortunate. I have my regular teaching job, and that pays our mortgage, and our son's food and all that. So I'm very lucky because I really do this out of my own interest, my own enjoyment. And then I love sharing it with fellow fans because I get excited. If I know that I'm excited about it, I presume a lot of other people are going to want to know this information. I've been really fortunate that Mr. Meyer has always said okay to me when I've asked for permission to share the information and to access his papers. I'm fortunate that CBS and Paramount allowed me to go in and look at the things that I looked at and take them so I can actually study them. Because I'll tell you, if I didn't have them, if I had to do this in the library, I would never have figured out that the timeline with Montalban. Yeah. I was only figured out because I was able to lay papers next to each other in my home and live with them for a while and realize dates and everything. So, I'm really just, very fortunate. And of course I'm trying to take what I already know from things like Larry's resources and the research that he's done, the books that have been done, the documentaries that have been done.
There's lots of stuff out there.
And sort of say what's new. And that's why I really wanted to focus on Space Seed and Wrath of Khan, both because of my admiration for them, but also because, no one's ever really looked at the making of an episode in super detail for the original show. And I think the way that it needs to be done. It's been, there's been compendiums for the original show and things like that, but those
maybe Tribbles with David's book.
Yeah, I think so. Yes. And I think, you know, they're, again, when you piece together different bonus features, you probably could do a good look at how things are done.
Level you're doing. When you get down to the nitty gritty of doing script drafts and call sheets and production memos, that's hard to do. I remember when I came out to work on the Companion, and all I wanted to do, when I realized what a call sheet had on it and how it was a gold mine of being a journal of just those 7 days, and nobody else in licensing or anything else got it, even production. They were like, yeah, sure, take them. We throw them away. And it's not like, I mean, like a value, like 30 years from now I'm going to do them in an auction, but just as an archival piece. Because
I mean, that's how, if you know, these
production throws stuff away. Yeah.
These photographs are, I just got a whole slew of new ones, and just actually finished last week of cleaning them, getting them ready, and now I'm going to start cataloging them. But I, well, like, one of the things that's in here is the Con Baby.
Oh, John, I was just going to ask you that. That's amazing. Do you know why it was taken out?
Yes. There had been a magazine many years ago that published a photograph, a very grainy photograph of a baby by the Genesis torpedo, and the story in the magazine basically said
in the Botany Bay shelters. Yeah.
This was a baby. It was also, but it was also a baby by the torpedo, as it was detonating. Right. So the idea was there was this is Khan's baby. I mean, that was sort of what the theme was, right? So, but you're right, Larry. There were babies there. So. I have these photographs, and they're pictures of Nicholas Meyer holding this kid, and it's a kid. He's got the Con clothes on. You know, it's not exactly Con's outfit, but it's Con's people's clothes. You know, and it's a costume for sure. And then there's second cameraman is there, and he's trying to film this kid crawling by the torpedo as it's going to detonate, right? So the original idea was that they were going to basically show a baby, a toddler, by the Genesis torpedo as it explodes, which would have been horrifically dark. But of course, it's the implication, right? If they have babies on board, they're going to die in the Reliant, right? I mean, that's the idea. So I have all these pictures of them trying to film this moment, and I had I asked Mr. Meyer about this, and what happened was the idea was just to show, it was not Khan's kid, it was just to show that Khan's people were reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said the idea just never, it didn't work. The idea didn't work, the moment didn't work. But those are the things that are in these pictures. There's the, you know, the extended scene with Kirk with his glasses. And they did film that where McCoy also teaches him what glasses are and how to use them. And I have all the photographs, and you see, you know, William Shatner adjusting his glasses and all that. And then there was an extended fight between between David and Kirk, where they both wind up on the floor and there's a big fist fight, not in the film. So these pictures almost necessitate doing research too, because you have to find out what's going on in this photograph. Why is there this baby that looks like Khan? You know, at least in Khan's clothes, why is there this baby? So the photographs have also been a really wonderful.
Especially if they don't have trims, they can go back and pull for a future. You know, if they can do a future deleted scene, and but they don't exist in archives, then you'd think they would have done it off the last photo.
Yeah, and I don't know how much of those were filmed. Yeah.
No, I had seen pictures of the baby in the Botany Bay shelters, like around some of the game boards and some of the tables. I've got one or two pictures of a baby there, and I had always meant to ask.
Very interesting. Very interesting, though. All right. Well, John, tell everyone where they can find you if they want to follow your work on this, find out when you have something new coming out, where you're going to be.
They can get me on Twitter at just J Tenuto. That's JTENUTO, or that same name at CLC Illinois, and just spell out Illinois, .edu, which is the college I work at, the College of Lake County in Grays Lake, or they can just get me through the website there. I always love talking to fans, so I'd love to hear from people. I'm doing a bunch of talks this year at libraries and for creation conventions and such, and for Wizard World in Chicago. So if people want to find out what the schedule is and maybe come see some of the pictures and that sort of thing, just shoot me an email or a message on Twitter.
Are you trying to plan to get back to Vegas this year?
No, actually, the Wizard World is the same weekend as Vegas, so I'm going to be. I thought I'd do that audience year, I guess. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But
okay.
The creation was kind enough to ask me to talk again in Chicago at the Chicago convention, which looks great because that's a whole TNG reunion. So I'm just excited to be there to see that.
Oh yeah, those are fun.
Well, how about you, Larry? If people want to track you down.
Twitter is just at Larry Nemechek, and my Trekland Facebook page, and then my LarryNemechek.com site with my archives, and the TreklandBlog.com for the blog and video. And of course, we're still working on the Wrathicon documentary, and the Wrathicon. I haven't done that in ages. The
you
Con of Wrath, which is the backside of the Wrathicon movie, 2 weeks after the movie comes out, and. The Con of Wrath documentary is still filming after a winter hiatus, and my Trekland CD series, which Mr. Jones helped remaster and produce, and it's at my LarryNemechek.com website. And hopefully some news here in the next month or two will be out about a couple of new things I'm working on.
Great. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us today. I wish we could talk for a few more hours about this, but definitely a lot of fascinating stuff in here.
Yeah, you're getting new stuff here. Hello, readers, listeners, you're getting new stuff from John that people have not peeked together before, so tell your friends and
neighbors. That's right.
Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think we're going to have to do a whole other Ready Room about the film itself. That was so much fascinating stuff about the development of the movie. I kind of feel like we should do a development episode on all the other films now, because that was so fascinating. And John has so much information that, you know, we didn't even get to all of it here tonight.
Well, not even close, yeah.
But, yeah, we didn't talk about the film itself, I don't think, any.
Right. I was thinking that as we were going along, I was thinking, we're going to have to do The Wrath of Khan Part 2, where we actually talk about the movie. But but actually, this is what I wanted to do today, was to talk about all the other stuff, because there's plenty of podcasts already where people have sat down and talked about The Wrath of Khan, because it's most everyone's favorite movie, or one of the favorites. So this was truly fascinating, all the information from John and from Larry.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead and get everyone out of here quickly, because I know this is a very long Ready Room. So if you want to contact us, go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can send a message to us. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And you can find us over on Twitter under username TrekFM. And Greg, what if people want to follow you?
Yes, well, if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm there at Greg Harbin, where you can see me either freaking out about sports ball or about some nerdy music like I was the other day, or just talking about some TV or films I'm watching. And then if you want to find sort of the alternate Greg, where I'm not talking about Star Trek most of the time, you can listen to The Observation Lounge, which is the other show I do on Trek FM, features Drew Stewart and Catherine Bryan, where we talk about pretty much all things not Trek. So if that interests you, please check it out.
All right. And if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much anywhere in the social media world under that name, just like you can find Trek FM under just Trek FM. And while we're talking about other shows, we touched on DS9, interestingly, a few times in here, talking about genetic engineering anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Fans of Deep Space Nine will want to check out the latest episode of the show that I do with Matthew Rushing, Literary Treks, where we sat down for, actually, Matthew sat down for the interview segment with Una McCormick and talked to her for a good hour or more about Deep Space Nine, the books that she's written, and it's very fascinating. And you'll find that at trek.fm/LT4. And if you want a short link over to Greg's show, just go to trek.fm/TOL, and that will get you there. And while you're there, check out all the other shows we have. We have 10 shows on the network now, and something for everyone from just about every corner of the Star Trek universe that you can think of and beyond, including Middle Earth. So go check everything out there. And we're going to go ahead and wrap things up this week. So, Greg, I'm going to wander off. I think I saw Khan's baby crawling through my living room earlier. I'm going to go see if it's behind the sofa.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a SETI eel in it, because the Ready Room is done.